So the next session is on research issues. It will prove to be entirely non-controversial and will be chaired by Kathy Pritchard and by Cliff Huddis, both of whom are known to you all, so I'll spare you the titles.
So some of you might actually wonder why I'm up here after my comments yesterday. I just want to reassure everybody. Yeah, no, well, there's that. But actually, the concern I expressed yesterday relates to sort of general practice. I think that what we're about to talk about in this session is really the crux of the agenda for the scientific aims that we all share. And there are a whole series of exciting talks focused on what we can actually do with preoperative specimens, which I think is really the point. So with no further ado, I'm going to invite Dr. Paik to join us. He's the director of the Division of Pathology for the NSABP. He's going to talk about the importance of getting preoperative research biopsies.
Good morning. It's a great honor to be here to give a presentation. Okay, so I guess everybody knows the importance of obtaining tissue for research. So what I'm going to do today is in a specific trial B27, how we are using the collected tissue samples to understand the kind of puzzling aspect of the clinical data. So there are obviously available tools for prognostication of patients in adjuvant setting that can identify high-risk patient, and we know that from a variety of studies, the high-risk patient derived the maximum benefit or greater benefit from chemotherapy. However, these tools are kind of probabilistic in that the tools cannot really tell who actually benefited from chemotherapy after getting the therapy and who need more than chemotherapy after chemotherapy is administered. So, for example, the Oncotype DX assay based on 16 cancer genes is a linear predictor of the distant recurrence for the ER positive node negative tamoxifen treated patient with increasing score correlated with the poor outcome. And we have demonstrated that in B20 that the increasing recurrence score also correlates with the increasing benefit of the chemotherapy. However, even looking at this curve, although we can kind of tell the residual risk of the patient who got chemotherapy at high risk, we don't actually know which patient actually derived actual benefit. On the other hand, in the adjuvant setting, pathological response provides a patient-specific kind of in vivo assessment of tumor response. However, it's not a perfect surrogate for survival endpoint in that in B27, even the doubling of PCR rate did not really translate into the half reduction of the doubling of the reduction of the mortality. And it does not provide baseline risk for the assessment, so you cannot just use PCR for prognostication. So in B27, as you know, in neoadjuvant setting, randomizing AC or AC followed by paclitaxel, the PCR was an excellent surrogate for survival outcome with highly statistically significant result. However, you can see that the no PCR patient also has a fairly good outcome. So although there was a doubling of the PCR rate when you add paclitaxel to AC, when you actually look at the clinical outcome, there was no difference, especially in the survival endpoint. So why is that? So it looks like there is really no perfect tools that we can use either in adjuvant setting or neoadjuvant setting to really make a patient-specific decision making. So the crux of the question is PCR a valid surrogate endpoint? So we can kind of look at the B18 data and do a simple mathematical extrapolation into B27 to understand what's going on. So if you look at the B18 data in the AC arm, there was about 15% complete pathological response. They had about 90% five-year survival, and the rest had about 75%. So you can kind of calculate the survival of all patients at 5 years to be about 77.25. So if you then extend that to ACT arm with doubling of the response rate, you can see that the actual expected difference between the survival endpoint and 5 years is only about 2%. So the trial itself was not really powered enough to be able to tell this difference. Now, if you keep on doing that exercise with increasing PCR rate, you can see that to show about 5% difference, you actually needed about 50% PCR rate. So it is probably the reason that we have such a small, expect such a small difference is because the non-PCR group actually has a fairly good prognosis. So when they are not responding to chemotherapy, why is their survival so good and not this deep? And our hypothesis is that it's a problem of patient selection in that this non-PCR patient is mixed with a good prognosis patient, inherently good prognosis patient, who doesn't really gain much benefit from chemotherapy, similar to what Dr. Jian has shown yesterday with Oncotype DXRC. So in order to address that hypothesis, we did a retrospective analysis of the B27 core biopsy samples. Now, this trial actually is in some sense tragic in the sense of research because of the ongoing debate of the genetic issues and informed consent issue. When we launched this trial, we couldn't really incorporate tissue collection into the main protocol. It had to be separated out. And while this is being debated and launched, almost 1 year has passed. And also, B27 as a successor of B18, following Fisher doctrine of minimal perturbation of the kinetics in the tumor, originally FNA was recommended over core biopsy. So by the time the B27.2, which is a core biopsy protocol, was launched, we lost a lot of patients. And initial planned markers include garden variety of IHC markers, but technology has evolved. So in the end, we actually had to develop a whole new method to a gene expression profile of the PARFIN block. So in the end, after about 5 years of effort in the lab, we were able to develop a method to profile the PARFIN block with Affymetrix gene chip. So we started with one section of the PARFIN block, core biopsy, and I extracted about 100 nanogram total RNA, amplified it, and using Affymetrix gene chip, hybridized and get the result on about expression profile of about 60,000 genes. And what I'm going to show you is a fairly preliminary look at the data, not really optimized analysis, but we used a prediction analysis of microarray and supervised principal component analysis to predict ER status, PCR, and outcome. So now, let me just go directly into the results. So if you disregard the PCR and simply regard it as a survival endpoint trial, and ask whether there is a gene signature that predicts outcome in this trial, and there is. There's about 90 genes that can actually robustly segregate low-risk versus high-risk patient half and half. Obviously, this is a continuous variable. I'm just showing you the median, middle cut of the data. And now what happens to this profile when you look at only non-PCR patient? Remember, our hypothesis is that non-PCR patient has a fairly good outcome because it's contaminated with fairly inherently good prognosis patient. That's exactly what it shows. If you look at no PCR patient and you look at the gene expression profile, about half of the patient actually has a low-risk profile, which has a very good outcome compared to the patient with high risk and no PCR. So I think we answered the question that the reason that we have the no survival difference, we couldn't detect survival difference even after doubling of the PCR was because this no PCR group is contaminated with good prognosis patient. Now, suppose if we actually conducted a trial with highly selected poor-risk patient, and then here's a original trial and here with no selection, and here's expected outcome with high-risk only patient based on gene expression, you can see that the expected difference for doubling of the PCR is much higher, about twice higher, a 4% difference when you actually, if you have conducted a trial with high-risk patient. Now, interestingly, in no PCR, low-risk patient, the PCR really didn't seem to matter on the prognosis. But obviously the patient number is very small to make much conclusion here. The important finding, I think, is that in high-risk patient by gene index, if they had PCR, they had much better outcome than the no PCR patient. So if you actually combine upfront gene expression profiling for prognosis And then use a neoadjuvant setting to assess the in vivo response, then you can actually identify these high-risk patients who didn't respond to chemotherapy. So they actually become probably the good candidate for post-neoadjuvant trials for targeted therapy or other therapies that the had mentioned yesterday. Now, can we predict PCR with gene expression? I think a lot of groups have tried it, and my answer is, I think, probably we cannot really accurately predict it. So if we simply look at the PCR rate according to this prognostic signature, obviously there is a higher PCR rate, doubling of the PCR rate, but a low-risk patient also has PCR. Now, the gene expression analysis that we conducted is produced a fairly pristine data, because although it was done with paraffin blood, because if you ask the gene expression data to predict ER status done by central assay, there is 96% accuracy in predicting ER status. So the data is fairly pristine. But if you then ask whether we can predict PCR with the gene expression signature, the accuracy goes down significantly, only 75%, and that's kind of the experience overall in the field. Now, we can increase that accuracy a little bit better to 85% if you restrict the analysis to only ER-negative patients. But again, still, it's not like estrogen receptor where there is a clear biological difference. So this could be because the tumor response is a fairly heterogeneous phenomenology influenced by many things in addition to the gene expression pattern within the tumor, maybe the dosing issues, duration issues in the patient, and the drug distribution issues requires to be calculated together with the gene expression status of the tumor. So in B40, we are actually mandating the pretreatment core biopsy collection in three forms. So RNA layer, so that we can have a very pristine gene expression analysis. And there can be RNA layer solution that allows collection of the tissue at room temperature and shipped it at room temperature and still preserves very good quality of RNA. And we actually found that in B27, there is a bias in the collection in such that the pathology department usually refused to send the core biopsy from patient with a PCR because that's the only block that contains the tumor. So if you look at my analysis, the PCR rate is significantly lower than the actual trial because of that fact. So we learned the lesson. So we are actually collecting additional core informal, and so that we will have a guaranteed research paraffin block that can be used to validate what we find in the fresh tissue RNA expression profile and also optimize it for the routine practice. And we are also looking at in vitro chemosensitivity assay by collecting tissue in Hank's buffer so that maybe instead of going through the PCR, maybe we can replace that with in vitro chemosensitivity assay in the end. So in conclusion, I think the gene expression analysis of the pretreatment core biopsy in B27 provided a biological explanation of the puzzle. And the combination of gene expression and the PCR in neoadjuvant setting may identify patients who need more than chemotherapy. And we want to validate that in collaboration with the ACTOR and NSABPP for your trials. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Soon. And it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Mitch Dowsett. Welcome, Mitch.
Thanks very much, Kathy. It's a real pleasure to be here at this really interesting meeting. Wait for the slides to come up. What do I do with this myself? It's happening. Okay. Well, I can see it. Yeah, we're good. Thanks. So the task I've got to do today is really to review the measures, proliferation and apoptosis, as being measures of response in neoadjuvant treatment. I'm going to hopefully move forward. Did I do it with this? Just this? I've got no movement in this. Shall I use that? Okay. So I'm going to cover two main topics here today, chemotherapy and endocrine therapy, and talk about particularly changes in proliferation and apoptosis and measures of response. I'll deal with the other types of novel therapies just in one slide at the very end. In going through this, I've chosen not to try to do a comprehensive review of all of the literature, but really to base most of the comments I'll make on our own data and focusing on relatively small but detailed sets of observations, because I think that's probably more meaningful in this situation. This is the sort of tissue that we use, and I think we all get. We've used these 14-gauge core cuts for many years now. They weigh, if you get a good core cut, which this, of course, is, about 30 milligrams, and you can get up to 30 micrograms of RNA from one of those. The average we get when we use RNA later and take a section from it for DNA and for an H&E is more like 10 micrograms. I'm going to be talking in terms of proliferation mainly about Ki-67, or Ki-67 as we call it in the UK, and apoptosis measured by the tunnel method. A tunnel, of course, actually works by linking in residues onto the short ends of DNA, which are created by the apoptotic process. And you can see this is a classical cell. It's actually in the presence of a field of normal untreated cells. Key point in this is that only about 1% of cells are apoptotic in an untreated breast cancer. We score about 3,000 cells for that, but that only gives us still 30 as our mean number. So there's an error in this. Just for completeness, I thought I would mention that, of course, there are other methods for measuring proliferation than Ki-67. People have used S-phase, mitotic index, of course, thymidine labeling index, the bromodeoxyuridine. We did actually review this in a JCO article a couple of years ago. Now, all of those really link into proliferation in a relatively similar fashion and correlate in a relatively good manner. In terms of apoptosis, probably the gold standard, in fact, remains morphology. And certainly when we apply the tunnel method, we always actually apply morphology on top of that. And whilst Ki-67 may be actually susceptible to image analysis in a relatively easy fashion, I'm not sure that apoptosis is. Other ways of measuring apoptosis include activated caspase 3, this M30, which is actually a serum assay. There are other methods or other components of cell death we also need to consider. Autophagy, which is actually just now beginning to become well-characterized, and possibly necrosis, which might even be localized necrosis. I was talking to Sandy Swain just briefly about the data that came from the Bekavizumab, which I always pronounce wrongly, data yesterday, where there seemed to be local sort of clusters of apoptosis, or you might even call it local necrosis, around the areas of the vessels. These are some of the data we derived early on, which just show you the error that you get from measuring Ki-67 or apoptosis by a tunnel, by two core cut biopsies from the same lesion at the same time, so no intervening treatment. And you can see here that the mean error is around about 33%. The mean standard deviation of the error is 16%. That's actually an approximation, because the error envelope here is, in fact, of this sort of shape. And really, that just gives an approximation. But it's useful for, I think, you to think about, because essentially that means that for any two measurements to be different from one another with 95% confidence, you need a 50% difference. And for apoptosis, it's near a 60% difference. I'm going to show you a lot of data with lines joining up measurements from individual patients, but you need to think, I think, around about that measure envelope around each of those points. Another thing to just think about is that the relationship there is between apoptosis and proliferation in an untreated tumor. This is 220 patients from the IMPACT trial, which I'll talk about later. You can see there is a very strong, highly significant, really strong relationship between Ki-67 and apoptosis. And we've found an R value which varies between 0.5 and about 0.65 in just about every subset of tumors we've looked at. So in fact, if you look at apoptosis as a univariate, and actually, high apoptosis is an indicator of poor outcome, which is actually counterintuitive. So just thinking about chemotherapy and some of the observations we've made there, we talked yesterday about high proliferation pre-treatment being an indicator of good response to chemotherapy, so a good predictive factor, but actually looking at a poor long-term outcome in relation to this, essentially a poor prognostic factor. I think most of us really would agree that if you can get a pathological complete remission, in a patient with the hyperproliferation, what we're really doing there is perhaps eradicating in at least some of those patients disease which would have otherwise been indicating poor outcome overall in that group of patients. So one really needs to think about this continuum when you're trying to think about response or not in the neoadjuvant chemotherapy situation. Data in terms of apoptosis in chemotherapy, and most of the chemotherapy I'm talking about here, I'm just talking about as chemotherapy. This is AC or other anthracycline-based regimens in the main. 24 hours after starting chemotherapy, you can see there is a substantial increase in the apoptotic index from this mean level of about 1%, highly statistically significant. And you also get a bit of a rundown in Ki-67. It is, in fact, significant here. You can see it's variable. It's fairly modest, about 15% overall. Neither of these, in our hands, have linked well into predicting response in the individual patient. Looking then at proliferation over a longer period and looking at the excision here, you can see clearly that by the time we get to excision, which is this series was between 3 months and 18 weeks after starting treatment, virtually all patients do show some degree of reduction in proliferation, but you still get some that don't change at all. I'm not going to show you data on apoptosis in this circumstance. We have data on that, but really the data out at excision is, I think, confusing. It's contradictory, and in part that's because many of these patients have, as you've seen in the pathological presentations, very few cells to work with. So getting 3,000 cells from that to get just 30 cells positive is really pretty tough, and we've had variable data. In terms of the relationship with clinical response, I've tried to just summarize it here. So thinking about proliferation and the pretreatment of 24-hour change, as I said, no real significant relationship there. But Andreas Makris, who's in the audience here, Jenny Chang and Laura Astersham, when they were with us, did individual series, and all of these showed significant relationships between the 21-day reduction in proliferation and clinical response. In terms of apoptosis, Jenny did a preliminary study with us which was reported as significant using an unusual methodology involving flow cytometry. When we used a rather more rugged methodology with Marina here, Marina Parton, we really weren't able to confirm that. Now, these data are the first time I've shown these data in public, and I think these will make up a small part of an ASCO presentation later this year. And it now looks at the actual Ki-67 in the excision specimen here and the matched pretreatment samples from those same patients. One thing, of course, to think about here is that none of these patients can be clinical, so complete pathological remitters, or indeed near complete pathological remitters, because we've got excision biopsy to work with. So the Ki-67, as you'd expect, does have a relationship. These are tertiles. You can see the cutoffs here based on the levels in the pretreatment specimen. A highly significant relationship, but when you get to the excision specimen, we really have radically poorer outcome in this high proliferative group. So again, I guess this is emphasizing that if you're high proliferation and you do not show a pathological complete remission, you're really looking pretty bad indeed. And again, these might be patients, as Soon was talking about, that will be candidates for a post-neoadjuvant a randomized study of some sort. Moving through to endocrine therapy, I'd say we've actually focused rather more on endocrine therapy in recent years. And speaking to you about the IMPACT study, which is a study which we've learned a great deal from, this, as Ian was saying yesterday, is the randomization of anastrozole versus tamoxifen versus a combination. And really we tried to mimic as best we could the attack protocol to see whether we could be predictive of the attack outcome here. We had biopsies pre-treatment at 2 weeks and then out here at 12 weeks. And you can see the numbers here. The biopsy at 2 weeks was not mandatory, but we got 159 samples from that all the same. The attack outcome, most of you will know, that we see this improvement of anastrozole over tamoxifen, the combination being very similar, I think a good control in this circumstance. We really wanted to know whether we could predict that. Firstly, coming into non-apoptosis, though, in this series, we found, against expectations really, that apoptosis was not increased in these patients, and we looked at this very thoroughly indeed. Indeed, it was decreased with all three of the arms at 2 weeks and at 12 weeks for anastrozole as well. And in fact, Ian referred to study 223 yesterday, which is an anastrozole alone arm, alone study, at least in one arm, and we were able to confirm that there. apoptosis actually decreases to some extent with the aromatase inhibitors. I think that's largely linked into that slide I showed you early on, where you have this strong relationship with apoptosis and proliferation. Clearly, the decrease in proliferation, which is shown here, markedly outweighs any decrease in apoptosis. And if you care to construct this so-called cell turnover index, which is a ratio of the two, for sure you get markedly decreased values. So these are the data just on the anastrozole. I could show you very similar data for tamoxifen and the combination. Profound changes by 2 weeks, largely the same at 12 weeks. And we focused a little bit on this yesterday as to whether or not these patients are recovering. We really don't know whether they're recoverers or whether they are within that error envelope I was talking about. Overall, the correlation between the 12-week values and the 2-week values is about 0.6. The overall data, which were really quite encouraging to us, clearly Ian again showed yesterday, show you that at 2 weeks, anastrozole suppresses by 76% out here, at 12 weeks by 80%. And in each circumstance, not only was it better than the than tamoxifen, it was also better than the combination, and therefore we felt did indeed predict the outcome of attack. What it we didn't do was actually predict clinical response in this same setting. I just focus here at the all patients, putting everybody together here at 2 weeks and at 12 weeks. The blue bar shows you the responders and a somewhat greater suppression of Ki-67 than in the purple bar there, but not statistically significant in this projected analysis. Now, I can squeeze, I can massage those data, and I can create a statistically significant result for you, but clearly the result is actually, there is no close relationship. Now, in this audience, this is a very, very naive slide to show, but I think it's something which has helped me think about how to think about these markers and what their relevance is to clinical response. So this tries to illustrate a tumor which is growing rapidly in the absence of treatment. In the presence of treatment, this rapidly growing tumor is impeded in its growth, but it does not regress. It is a non-responder. It's progressive disease by our common terms. But proliferation, of course, is markedly suppressed in that circumstance. Here's another patient. This patient actually, slower growing, similar overall response, but in this case, because she was slower growing, she creates a response. She's now a partial responder, and the Ki-67, of course, is decreased. If we link this to recurrence-free survival, we would expect the prognosis of both these to be somewhat poorer than here. But in both cases, the actual benefit from treatment comes through because we're jacking up the line these patients are expecting to actually recur less quickly. So essentially, a change in proliferation is likely, I think, I think it is rational to expect a change in proliferation to predict outcome in the adjuvant setting somewhat better than predicting response in the neoadjuvant setting. Just briefly looking now at the two-week data in more detail, there are 56 patients on here, 52 of whom show some reduction in proliferation. So there seems to be a continuum in benefit here. You can see that the changes are very variable. Some of the patients at the highest levels in particular show very modest reductions in proliferation, but others show profound changes in proliferation. And this got us sort of thinking over the last 12 months or so in how to perhaps conceptualize the Ki-67 at these various time points. And the way we sort of started thinking was that, well, perhaps baseline Ki-67 will be expected to be prognostic, as we would all expect, and the change between the pre-treatment and the two-week would be predictive of the benefit of treatment from that particular agent. And then the two-week value then might integrate this sort of intrinsic prognostic value with the predictive value, such that this point out at 2 weeks, it wouldn't matter where you started from, but it mattered where you ended up, as long as you were on that particular endocrine treatment. So rationally, the two-week Ki-67 should relate to outcome on anastrozole more closely than baseline Ki-67. And these, of course, the data, we published these in JNCI just, about a month or so ago, tertiles again of now log Ki-67, showing you that at baseline, the patients with the highest Ki-67 have the poorest outcome, as expected. But then when we look at the two-week log Ki-67, the separation is much cleaner, much greater, the p-value is smaller. But most importantly, I mean, I've shown you those as tertiles. The analysis was based as a continuous analysis. When we put all of this in together and say the pre-treatment values in and the two-week values in, what actually stays in the multivariate prediction of recurrence-free survival? Well, tumor size is in there, and two-week Ki-67, but not pre-treatment Ki-67, and interestingly, two-week ER, but not pre-treatment ER, remained in there. Now, this is the thing we're going to be looking at further in this POETIC trial, which Ian described, really trying to see whether we can confirm whether these two-week measurements are more predictive or more accurate in prediction than at baseline. Now, just lastly, I wanted to show you a couple of slides from a study in which we are measuring proliferation, but some other features as well. This is one of these window of opportunity studies, which I know Matt's going to talk about a little bit more shortly. And what we've done here, there's 35 estrogen receptor positive patients in here. They received anastrozole or letrozole, doesn't matter very much as far as this analysis is concerned. And then we ended up using a cDNA microarray with 17,500 features, looking at both the biopsy and the excision sample. One of the interesting things here is when we throw all those 70 samples into the microarray and the 17,000 features each and do a clustering analysis, we find that we pull apart about half of the pairs. So about there's 18 of the pairs stay together here at the first level of clustering, but then 17 are pulled apart. And over here in this arm, you won't really be able to see it here, but the Bs are the two-week sample, 20 of the 25 lines there are B samples. So this treatment seems to be making the samples much more like post-treatment samples than like their partner pre-treatment samples as far as these are concerned. That's something we've seen much more with endocrine therapy than we've seen with chemotherapy. Just illustrating, I think, the power of this study, we've constructed the most naive bioinformatic tool you can get, which is called, we're calling it the Global Index of Dependence on Estrogen, a guide. And that is just counting the number of genes which change up or down, not worried about the direction, beyond a given threshold. And we've just chosen twofold here. And I'm going to show you how that index relates to the concentration of estrogen receptor and HER2 status. The guide is shown here. Obviously, I'm not looking for you to actually see the details here, but essentially, we've just ordered this by the highest guide down to the lowest guide. And I think it's just worthwhile reflecting for a second. All of these are estrogen receptor positive patients. All of them have received an aromatase inhibitor. Yet in this case, we've got 4,000 genes change, and in this case, 79 genes change within the breast tumor, and a continuum throughout. In terms of the estrogen receptor, the green values here are the 9 with the highest estrogen receptor levels, the red with the lowest. Separating, I guess, as we'd really expect, with some of the high estrogen receptor levels not getting a particularly good response. None of the patients with the low estrogen receptor levels getting a very good response. And the 4 amplified HER2 cases here are down with low guides. Now, that's a very naive treatment of the data. I think it's interesting to just think about in terms of it showing this continuum. But clearly, we want to break into this now and try to understand the features that make up that guide. Proliferation is going to be one of them. It's going to be about 1 minute, Kathy, I think. Proliferation is one of them. We would expect, I think, other features to be important in determining the outcome of the patients, and that's what we want to try to get at here with the POETIC trial in particular, by getting large numbers of patients with pairs of samples where we can look at the molecular makeup of those. We can determine the estrogen dependence of the feature. We can hopefully determine the importance of the clinical benefit of changing that feature by estrogen deprivation. And hopefully in the pre-treatment samples can look at the determinants of response of that feature to estrogen deprivation. This POETIC study, if it comes off, will actually involve 4,000 patients, 2,600 of which will have short-term pre-surgical aromatase inhibitor treatment. So just trying to summarize, as far as chemotherapy is concerned, decreased proliferation is associated with response to treatment. High residual Ki-67 is associated with a very poor recurrence-free survival. An increased apoptosis occurs in response to therapy, but there doesn't seem to be a close relationship with response. In the endocrine treatment situation, decreased proliferation may predict for treatment benefit, but again, there's no close relationship with clinical response. High two-week Ki-67 is associated, again, with poor recurrence-free survival. An increased apoptosis does not occur at 2 weeks or 12 weeks with tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor. And lastly, just this word about novel agents. I've just talked about endocrine therapy and chemotherapy here. I think there, with the endocrine agents we've seen, there have been very consistent effects. I think we need to be open-minded about which of these features which determine response are going to be affected by the growth factor inhibitors, the anti-angiogenic agents, etc. Early studies, detailed studies, will determine how we actually utilize these as markers of response. Okay, thanks for your attention.
So our next speaker is Marco Coglione from the European Institute of Oncology, where he's the director of the Research Unit in Medical Sinology in the Department of Medicine. We'll talk about the chemotherapy response and ER, PR, and HER2, HER1 status.
Well, thank you, Cliff. I would like to thank also the organizer of the meeting for giving me the opportunity to join this important conference. What I would like to do in the next 15 minutes is to present some data, hopefully not already presented during this meeting, which is quite difficult to some extent, on the correlation between the response to preoperative chemotherapy and selected factors, including steroid hormone receptors and type 1 tyrosine receptor, namely in R1 and R2. The mouse, perfect. It seems perfect. Okay. I would like to discuss both the predictive and prognostic value of these factors, in other words, the characteristics of the tumor which might predict the magnitude of the response to a given treatment, and also the characteristics which might predict the disease outcome of the patients. And why should we focus on ERPGR, R1, and R2? Well, there are some data which indicate that the patterns of treatment outcome might be related to this factor, either alone or in combination. In fact, we know that tumors that lacking ER and PGR might be particularly sensitive to preoperative chemotherapy, and that R1 and R2 might be linked not only with resistance to chemotherapy, but also to worse prognosis, and there might be also a relationship between these factors. In other words, there are subgroups of breast cancer tumors like ER positive and PGR negative, which might overexpress R1 and R2. So the question is, can we use these markers to tailor preoperative chemotherapy? Well, the content of this slide is well known by the audience because several authors already spoke about this during the meeting. It summarized the results of the probability of achieving a pathologic complete remission according to the steroid hormone receptors, and as you know, there is a significantly higher probability of achieving a PCR in those patients whose tumor do not express steroid hormone receptors if compared with those tumors with some expression of steroid hormone receptors. But I would like to focus on the fact that there was a large variation in both the definition of PCR and the hormone receptor positivity definition in these studies. In fact, for several authors, PCR consisted in no evidence of invasive breast cancer cells in the primary tumor, whereas in other studies, both in the primary tumor and in the axilla, the absence was considered as a criteria for a pathologic complete remission. But also, the evaluation of positivity for steroid hormone receptor significantly changed between studies, as these are mainly old studies, retrospective analysis, so several studies used the biochemical assay, others used the immunohistochemistry, others used both during the time frame of the study. And also several consider only ER positive as a criteria for hormone receptor positivity. Others consider ER and or PGR positive. And I would like to focus only on the problem of the cutoff. In fact, in our experience in our institute, we found a significant difference in the probability of achievement of pathologic complete remission only for the subgroup of tumors with no expression, 0% of both ER and PGR, if compared with the cohort of patients with some expression of steroid hormone receptor or with positive steroid hormone receptor. So the cutoff might be relevant for the definition of a population with a true chemotherapy response disease. This slide summarizes the results for disease-free survival according to sterile hormone receptors, and at least for early relapse, as shown in this slide, all the studies are consistent. There is a clear poorer disease-free survival for hormone receptor-negative tumors, the tumors who respond very well to preoperative chemotherapy if compared with the cohort of patients with hormone receptor-positive tumors. And we have evidence in the literature that also for those patients with residual axillary disease at final surgery after preoperative chemotherapy, there is evidence that in the cohort of patients with ER-negative tumors, there was a significantly poorer 5 years relapse-free survival and 5 years overall survival if compared with the cohorts of patients whose tumors were ER-positive. There are quite few data in the literature about late disease-free survival, or better, disease-free survival after prolonged observation, prolonged follow-up. And this study from the MD Anderson clearly showed that the time course of breast cancer after preoperative chemotherapy, according to steroid hormone receptors, is to some extent quite complex. In fact, there was a clear poor disease-free survival at 5 years for hormone receptor-negative tumors if compared with hormone receptor-positive cohort. But after about 100 months, the curves crossed. At the 10 years, there was significantly poorer disease-free survival for hormone receptor-positive if compared with hormone receptor-negative tumors. This study confirmed also the importance of the achievement of a pathologic complete remission both in the cohort of hormone receptor-positive and in the cohort of hormone receptor-negative tumors. In fact, the achievement of a PCR significantly correlated with prolonged disease-free survival both in the cohort of hormone receptor-negative and hormone receptor-positive tumors if compared with those patients who failed to achieve a pathologic complete remission. The figures for overall survival after prolonged observation is in line with the results previously showed for disease-free survival. There was a poorer overall survival at 5 years for hormone receptor negative compared with hormone receptor positive, but at 10 years the curves crossed and there was a poorer disease-free overall survival for hormone receptor positive if compared with hormone receptor negative. And once again, the achievement of PCR significantly correlated with prolonged overall survival both for the cohort of hormone receptor negative and the cohort of hormone receptor positive disease. Going to HER2 evaluation, there was a large variation in the methodology used in past trial for the assessment of HER2 positivity. In fact, several studies considered only amplified tumors as for HER2 as positive. Other studies consider as positive both the 3+ through immunohistochemistry and amplified tumors. Others consider only immunohistochemistry, but 2+ or 3+. And other studies did not follow the classical criteria based on intensity, completeness, and number of positive cells in order to define HER2 positivity. And also the cutoff used for the definition of positivity range between 1 and 10%. So we know now from the, for example, the ASCO guidelines that this might not be the proper cutoff for the definition of a true HER2 positive population. With all these limitations, with all these limits, I summarized in these slides the probability of achievement of pathologic complete remission according to HER2, and that there was no clear evidence of a different probability of PCR for HER2-positive diseases compared with HER2-negative disease, with the exception of the largest trial from the MD Anderson that showed clearly that there was a significantly higher PCR rate for HER2-positive disease if compared with HER2-negative disease. It was of interest that in this study, authors evaluated both ER and HER2, and they found that the highest probability for the achievement of PCR was for the cohort with endocrine non-responsive disease, ER-negative, HER2-positive, 29%, which decreased to 6% for the population with the endocrine responsive disease, ER-positive, but HER2-negative. This is the slide that summarizes the results for disease-free survival according to HER2, and at least for the larger trials, there is an evidence of a poorer disease-free survival 5 years for HER2-positive disease if compared with HER2-negative disease after preoperative chemotherapy. I would like very briefly to present the updated results of the study that we conducted together with the International Breast Cancer Study Group, just to show that we confirmed all the data already I presented now. In fact, we confirmed that for the population, about 500 patients analyzed, for the population with ER and PGR absent tumors, there were a significantly higher probability of PCR. We failed to observe a difference in the achievement of PCR for HER2 positive diseases compared with HER2 negative diseases, although there was a trend to a higher probability of PCR. But most important, we confirm with our updated results that for the population with the ER and PGR absent tumor, there was a significantly poorer disease-free and overall survival at 5 years if compared with tumor with some expression of steroid hormone receptor, which was confirmed at the multivariate analysis. There was also evidence of a poorer disease-free survival and overall survival for HER2-positive diseases compared with HER2-negative disease, but this was not confirmed after a multivariate analysis. And I would like to very briefly show you this exploratory biomarker analysis we performed. This is just hypothesis generating, but just to show that the patterns of treatment outcome might be related to the combination of ER, PGR, and HER2. In fact, we found that the best disease-free and overall survival for the subgroup with ER and PGR-positive disease, 74% disease-free survival, 90% overall survival, which decreased to 65% and 81% in the population with ER-positive and PGR-absent tumors, where we know there might be some expression of both R1 and R2. And for the subgroup with the so-called triple negative, we know this is a very heterogeneous disease. There was a decreased 5-year disease-free survival to 50%, overall survival to 69%, but the worst disease-free survival and overall survival, as other authors already reported, was observed for the cohort of patients with ER and PGR absent tumor and HER2 positive disease. So these data support the fact that in the future, tailored treatment, targeted treatment, should be reserved in selected subgroup of patients. Going through the last factors, HER1, very few data available in the literature for preoperative chemotherapy and HER1. As indicated in these two studies, there was no clear difference in the probability of achievement of PCR for HER1 positive disease compared with HER1 negative disease. In the first of these trials, there was a trend to a poorer overall survival for HER1 positive if compared with HER1 negative disease. But in this trial from the MD Anderson, there was a clear poorer disease-free survival and overall survival for HER1 positive disease if compared with HER1 negative disease. So in summary, for steroid hormone receptor status, negative hormone receptor status is one of the strongest predictive markers for preoperative chemotherapy. As shown before, receptor status is also prognostic, but the time course of the disease is complex and the results change it according to the time of the observation, to the duration of the follow-up. There is controversy about the role of HER2-positive status as a predictor of response to preoperative chemotherapy. Studies indicated the worst outcome for HER2-positive compared with HER2-negative disease, but there is clear need for standardized criteria to define HER2-positive tumor in order to allow cross-study comparison. And there are very limited data available about HER1, need for further studies. It seems not to be a consistent predictive response, but it may have a prognostic significance. And I would like to conclude saying that up to date, there are very limited information on how to tailor a treatment for an individual patient. There are patterns of treatment that come very different in the selected subpopulation with a major contrast between endocrine-responsive and endocrine non-responsive disease. But the development of tailored research for specific niches of patients is priority for future trials. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Marco. Thank you for that talk. And next, I'd like to introduce Dr. Leos Pustai from MD Anderson Hospital, who's going to speak to us about molecular profiling.
Thank you. I would like to thank the organizing committee for inviting me to this meeting. I would like to discuss the value of gene expression profiling that it may contribute to new adjuvant studies. So how do I move these slides?
Use the mouse.
Oh, the mouse, okay. That doesn't come. Okay, so I just use the keyboard. So I will briefly review the potential uses of gene expression profiling in the neoadjuvant treatment setting and the limitations of the technology. I was also asked to comment on the relative merit of single baseline biopsy-based discovery strategies compared to serial biopsies during treatment. I will also address some issues around sample size calculations and genomic studies. So, preoperative therapy offers a unique opportunity to correlate baseline molecular markers with subsequent response to treatment. The most common justification for gene expression profiling in neoadjuvant studies is to test the hypothesis that new mRNA expression-based predictors of response could be discovered. The predictor could be a single gene or a combination of many genes, and one could also test a priori defined predictors of response. A second important but underappreciated reason to perform molecular profiling of cancers, including in clinical trials, is that this will create a molecular database. This database represents a comprehensive inventory of the molecular machinery of cancer at the mRNA level. It is important to realize the scientific value of creating such databases. So a molecular database can have at least the same, if not greater, research value than a clinical database that we routinely create for all studies. This, of course, assumes that we accept gene expression profiling with DNA microarrays as a reliable measure of mRNA expression. I do not have time to present data to support this assumption. However, this data exists. A comprehensive quality assurance, quality assessment of this technology has been performed, including extensive comparisons with RT-PCR measurements, and the results were published in a series of articles in Nature Biotechnology late last year. And this is on the slide for your reference. So I would like to illustrate the value of publicly available gene expression databases through two examples. The biomarker literature is full of markers that are associated with better or worse prognosis in various clinical trials. However, in most clinical trials, patients receive, quite appropriately, multiple different therapies, including surgery, chemotherapy, and endocrine therapy. The critical and often unanswered question regarding the proposed marker is whether the marker predicts prognosis or predicts sensitivity to particular therapy. With the advent of prospectively generated public gene expression databases, these questions can now be addressed for mRNA-based measurements of markers. This slide contains reference to three such databases. The first includes 286 node-negative breast cancers that were treated with surgery alone. The second includes 267 ER-positive patients treated with 5 years tamoxifen. The third one includes 133 patients who received neoadjuvant TFAC, Taxol or paclitaxel FAC chemotherapy. All use the same gene expression profiling platform, and relevant clinical outcome data is available for each case. You can test any of your favorite gene signature, or molecular pathway in these data sets to examine separately its prognostic or chemo or endocrine response predictive values. We tested the predictive value of microtubule binding protein tau, our favorite gene, in ER-positive breast cancers. The results are shown in this slide. In the prognostic data set, which is the first panel, there was no difference in tau expression between those who relapsed and those who did not at 5 years. Therefore, tau has no significant prognostic value. In the tamoxifen-treated data set, those who relapsed had significantly lower tau expression compared to those who did not. This suggests that patients with low tau expression do not benefit from tamoxifen as much as those with higher tau expression. Kaplan-Meier survival curves are also shown by tertiles of tau expression on the lower half of the slide. In the neoadjuvant paclitaxel FAC dataset, which is the third panel, we examined if tau expression correlated with pathological complete response to this chemotherapy, and we observed that patients with pathological complete response indeed had a significantly lower tau expression compared to those with residual disease. In summary, through the combined analysis of these three publicly available datasets, we could establish that this particular single marker does not predict prognosis in the absence of systemic therapy, but it may identify a subset of ER-positive patients who are at risk of recurrence with tamoxifen alone, and at the same time are also highly sensitive to chemotherapy. In the second example, investigators examined the value of an a priori defined predictive signature that were developed from cell line models. Predictors of response to paclitaxel-5-FU, doxorubicin, and cyclophosphamide in vitro were applied to human gene expression data from patients who underwent preoperative chemotherapy. The same neoadjuvant data set, as described on the previous slide, was used. The investigators reported that patients who were predicted to respond using the cell line-based predictor indeed had higher rates of pathological CR. Regardless whether this predictor will hold up in future validation studies, the important message is that this research approach is feasible, and it is made feasible by publicly available gene expression data. I would like to return to the main use of transcriptional profiling in the context of neoadjuvant studies. This is to discover new predictors of response to therapy. I believe this is possible. Several such predictors have been published and some even tested in small independent validation studies. We recently reviewed accomplishments in this field in a review article that is provided as a reference on this slide. However, the limitations of this technology are also becoming clearer and must be considered. So challenges, some of the challenges in this field are well known. Low response rates seen in small discovery studies pose a serious statistical challenge. Also, frequently, over 20,000 individual gene expression measurements are compared in the process of searching for differentially expressed genes that are associated with response. The risk of false discovery is therefore high. However, there are several statistical methods to adjust for multiple comparisons. What I would like to bring your attention to is another lesser-known confounder. This is the association between clinical pathological variables and large-scale gene expression patterns. The expression, the estrogen receptor expression and histological grade are associated with large-scale gene expression patterns. ER-positive cancers differ from ER-negative tumors in the expression of well over 2,000 genes. High-grade tumors differ from low-grade tumors almost to the same extent. Both ER-negative status and high-grade are also associated with greater sensitivity to many different chemotherapies. Therefore, an adjusted comparison, pharmacogenomic comparison of responders with non-responders will yield gene lists that are dominated by ER and grade-associated genes. There are several statistical methods to adjust for these covariables. Small sample size often makes these adjustments difficult. However, when such adjustments are made, the number of informative genes drops dramatically. This slide shows that when we perform unadjusted comparison to identify differentially expressed genes between those who have complete response and those who have residual disease, greater than 1,000 genes can be identified with a predicted false discovery rate of 5%. This means that only about 5% of these genes may not be truly differentially expressed. However, when we match cases by ER and grade, it becomes statistically difficult to identify genes with confidence that are differentially expressed. In this case-control study, shown on the left panel, no gene could be detected with a false discovery rate less than 5% when ER and grade were matched. I would like to emphasize that this does not mean that there are no truly differentially expressed genes between responders and non-responders, other than the genes regulated by ER status and histological grade. These results only show that this particular discovery strategy can be high risk for false positive results. To further illustrate this, this slide shows the top 10 differentially expressed genes identified in the previous case-control study. The p-values for all these genes are very low, but the predicted false discovery rate associated with this list is 50%. This means that half of these genes may represent real discovery, the other half not. Importantly, two of the top 10 probes included topoisomerase 2, which was overexpressed in patients who had pathologic CR to the FAC, neoadjuvant chemotherapy. This is consistent with prior knowledge that implicates TOPO2 as the currently best single gene predictor of increased sensitivity to anthracyclines. However, which of the remaining eight genes represent true markers of response versus spurious discovery, we will only know with further experiments. I would like to emphasize that strong associations between ER grade and large-scale gene expression patterns bias pharmacogenomic discovery towards finding general chemotherapy sensitivity signatures. In fact, these predictors may be, to a large extent, the molecular equivalence of a combined ER and grade score. Nevertheless, these signatures still could be useful. Several publications suggested that gene signatures that are predictive of prognosis or response to therapy track clinical variable-based predictions closely, but not perfectly. Also, they appear to outperform or at least complement clinical variable-based prediction models. In our experience, a genomic predictor of pathological CR showed higher sensitivity and greater value to rule out who will not achieve this favorable response than a clinical predictor based on a combination of ER grade and age. It is also very important to keep in mind that by identifying the molecular differences between low-grade and high-grade tumors and between ER-positive and ER-negative cancers, we increase our understanding of cancer biology. We hope that this will eventually translate not only to better treatment selection, but to better drugs for therapy. I was specifically asked to at least touch on the complex issues of designing pharmacogenomic predictor studies. There is a vast literature on sample size calculations for genomic discovery studies. As all sample size calculations, these are based on certain assumptions about the study population, the predictor to be discovered, and the response rate. There are two main approaches to estimate sample size. One is based on powering the study to identify individual differentially expressed genes. The other uses existing and accumulating data to assess predictor performance as sample size increases and estimates projected performance for a larger sample size. Examples are shown on this slide. The upper table shows how discovery sample size increases as the mean difference decreases relative to the standard deviation, described as standard effect size in statistical terms, for any particular gene. The estimated sample size that is needed for discovery also increases as the response rate decreases. The lower panel shows learning curves for genomic predictors in different data sets. These curves are generated by developing predictors from increasingly bigger and bigger data sets and extrapolating from these observed results how the predictor would work if developed from larger data sets. Please note that the steepness of these learning curves varies from data set to data set. This means that for different prediction problems, different discovery sample sizes may be appropriate. Validation studies are easier to design because more is known about the performance of the predictor. However, different investigators may have different definitions of validation. For example, one could define validation as proving that marker-positive patients have definitely higher pathological CR rate than unselected or marker-negative patients. This would require showing that the lower bound of the 95% confidence interval of the positive predictive value of the test is greater than the upper bound of the 95% confidence interval of the pathological CR rate in unselected patients. Others may argue that it may be more important to know the precision of the test with great certainty. This would require to power the study so that the standard deviation around the point estimate is acceptably low. I would like to point out that even a technically validated and accurate test may not necessarily improve clinical outcome of the tested population. Therefore, the ultimate and most important validation of any diagnostic assay is to show that it improves patient outcome. I was also charged with discussing the potential research uses of gene expression profiling on serial biopsies collected before and during therapy. The rationale for this approach is that transcriptional changes in response to therapy will be more predictive of outcome than a baseline gene expression signature. This makes sense, but this approach is also fraught with additional challenges. In addition to all of the caveats that apply to developing predictors from single pretreatment biopsies, there are a number of other problems that make successful discovery from serial biopsies difficult. The optimal timing of taking the follow-up biopsy is usually unknown. There is substantial time variation due to non-compliance. There is missing data after all patients exercise their right that these are optional procedures. However, what I would like to draw your attention to is a challenge that relates to gene expression profiling technology itself. Important changes in the expression of a few dozen genes in response to therapy may be blurred by technical noise. This slide shows a scatter plot of replicate experiments. The same RNA was profiled on two separate occasions, and the results of 24,000 individual measurements are plotted against each other. A perfect correlation and 100% concordance of results would be a straight line at a 45-degree angle. What you see here is pretty close to it. The concordance of these replicate measurements was 98%. However, this very high reproducibility still allows for approximately 1.3% of all genes to have greater or equal than twofold difference. This translates into over 300 genes. The implications of this are very important. Modest changes in the expression of a few dozen genes may not be readily discernible in the background of this technical noise in a small study. This slide is a scatter plot of gene expression data of the same tumor before and 48 hours after doxorubicin docetaxel preoperative chemotherapy. you cannot avoid to notice the similarity to the previous slide. The transcriptional changes in response to chemotherapy are very small compared to the stability of the vast majority of gene expression measurements. In fact, in a small pilot study, we could not identify any single gene that showed consistent change in its expression in response to the given chemotherapy. I have no doubt that such genes exist, but a substantially larger sample size than most phase 2 neoadjuvant studies will be needed to identify them with any degree of statistical certainty. So I would like to return to the various genomic predictions or predictors that have been published or publicly presented, and I believe are ready to be tested for their value in clinical trials. There are at least two multi-gene prognostic models that underwent several rounds of validation. Also, many groups have shown that mRNA-based ER and HER2 measurements correspond closely to immunohistochemistry and FISH results, and may even be more accurate. There are several multi-gene predictors that could define a subset of ER-positive patients who are highly sensitive to endocrine therapy. Some of these, such as Oncotype DX, have been studied more extensively than others. Nevertheless, there are more than one endocrine response predictors that are ready to be tested in the clinic. Similarly, there are numerous gene signatures that appear to identify individuals with substantially higher than average chemotherapy sensitivity. Most importantly, what you see on this slide, that is multiple genomic predictions, genomic prediction reports from a single biopsy, is technically feasible today. All of the previously shown genomic tests are imperfect. The predictive results often come with considerably large confidence intervals, indicating uncertainty in the true predictive values. I believe an important challenge for us is to find out how one can integrate a series of imperfect tests into a clinically useful diagnostic strategy. We have done this with some success in the field of diagnostic imaging. This is our strategy to integrate our genomic predictors into a neoadjuvant clinical trial. Patients who are willing to participate in this molecular triaging program will undergo a single needle biopsy for gene expression profiling. We will examine ER and HER2 status by mRNA-based methods as well as with routine diagnostic methods. For the ER-positive patients, we will also estimate endocrine sensitivity by applying a 200-gene endocrine sensitivity index. We will also make a prediction regarding sensitivity to paclitaxel FAC chemotherapy by using a 30-gene prediction of pathologic CR. Those who overexpress HER2 will receive trastuzumab-containing preoperative chemotherapy. Those who are predicted to accomplish pathologic CR to neoadjuvant paclitaxel FAC will receive that chemotherapy. And those who are predicted to be highly sensitive to endocrine therapy but not sensitive to chemotherapy will receive 6 months of preoperative endocrine treatment. Each of these treatment arms will serve as separate validation studies for the particular predictor that was used for the triaging. An important fourth group of patients include those who are predicted not to accomplish pathologic CR and are also predicted not to be sensitive to endocrine therapies. These patients are in need for more effective new treatments. Therefore, we will offer for these individuals participation in investigational therapeutic studies on a separate protocol. Please note that a simple way to measure a clinical value of this triaging approach is to calculate the pathological CR rate for the entire triaged group. If this approach indeed selects patients for the most appropriate treatment modality, then the overall pathological CR rate for the group must be significantly higher than the well-established historical pathological CR rate of 25% that is achieved if we treat all patients with our current best chemotherapy. You may be interested to see how chemo and endocrine sensitivity predictions relate to each other. We applied the 200-gene endocrine sensitivity index and the 30-gene pathologic CR predictor to the same 126 cases. Approximately half of those with low sensitivity to endocrine therapy were predicted to accomplish pathological CR. On the other hand, almost no patients with intermediate or high endocrine sensitivity were predicted to achieve this favorable response to chemotherapy. These observations are consistent with clinical experience and with the reports of other pharmacogenomic research groups. An important question remains how to treat those who are predicted not to do well with existing therapies. One simple approach is to treat these individuals with the best current standard therapy plus a promising new drug, for example, bevacizumab. However, it is also possible to design more molecularly tailored studies and also test the predictive value of a particular gene signature. This slide shows an example. Dasatinib is a multi-targeted kinase inhibitor. It binds at least 19 different kinases, including the SARC family. Bristol-Myers Squibb also developed and published a genomic predictor of dasatinib response. Using gene expression data, it is possible to simultaneously calculate several different potential predictors for dasatinib response. For example, one can measure the expression of all the targets of dasatinib and calculate the combined target index to identify those who have a very high target expression. One can also examine the activity of the SARC pathway in each tumor by calculating a pathway index using already published literature. And one could also apply the Bristol-Myers Squibb predictor. We have performed all of these calculations and superimposed the results on the chemotherapy response prediction. This slide shows a two-way scatter plot of a dasatinib target index on the x-axis and the BMS prediction scores on the y-axis. Each dot represents one tumor. Cancers predicted not to achieve pathologic CR to paclitaxel FAC are marked with the small black squares around them. These individuals, if they also have a high score on at least one of the three distinct dasatinib predictors, could be considered eligible for dasatinib in combination with standard chemotherapy. The goal of such study would be to increase pathological CR rate to significantly above the rate that is predicted with standard chemotherapy alone, which is about 5%. Clearly, this design will not address the activity of dasatinib or any other new drug tested in this manner in patients with other molecular characteristics or in unselected patients. However, this can easily be done with some modifications to this design in a separate study. So in conclusion, I would like to stress that genes are not independent variables. There are large-scale coordinated expression patterns that are associated with clinical variables. This helps to discover general chemotherapy sensitivity signatures, but at the same time, it hinders the discovery of regimen-specific markers. Microarrays give a reliable and reproducible snapshot of global gene expression status of breast cancer. This allows building a large molecular database that will be an invaluable resource for discovery and hypothesis testing. Raw data must be made public, and a uniform platform is desirable if you want to accomplish this. I believe time is right to start to test the clinical value of response predictors, be they are single genes or multi-gene predictors, prospectively. Oncotype DX, our 30-gene predictor, topoisomerase II, luminal A molecular class, and several others are available to be tested in clinical trials. I think individually moderately accurate predictors may be assembled in the future into a clinically relevant diagnostic strategy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We're going to take 10 minutes for coffee, come back at 10 after. I would encourage all the after-break speakers to follow the excellent model of Dr. Soon Paik. This morning was our model. He not only gave a great talk, but he came in at 11 minutes. Thank you.
Thanks. And the meeting planners have asked that if anybody here is going to need a taxi at the end of the conference, either now during the break or at lunch, you can request it and the time at the registration desk.
All right, folks. So in the interest of staying close to on schedule, we're going to go ahead and get started. Our next speaker is David Menkoff. He's a professor in the radiology department at the University of Washington School of Medicine. He's going to talk about PET, MRI, and other imaging. David, thank you for being the sacrificial lamb and starting as the room drifts in. We understand.
Thank you. So all of you that are back in the room, you're going to get it because the first slide or two is critical, so you'll just have to fill everybody else as they come back in. I wanted to thank Julie, Eric, and Joanne for including me in this process, and actually for being enlightened enough to have in vivo imaging in addition to in vitro assay as part of the lecture. And so I wanted to thank you all very much. I've really enjoyed this conference, and I hope that you'll see by the end of this talk, especially following this very nice set of discussions of tissue assay, how in vivo imaging is really complementary to the type of information that you get from those assays that we've just heard about. So the goals that I've been charged with today are to, number one, talk about research goals, to really set the stage for why we would want to do imaging in a research study,
And as we said in the organizing committee, I'll give you an imaging 101 and just tell you what some of the modalities are, especially functioning on those, emphasizing those functional imaging modalities. And then I'll go through very briefly some examples where research is beginning to have bear fruit, to show some examples of how imaging can be helpful in these goals, and then briefly talk about future directions. And I promised the organizers I would do that all within my 20 minutes of allotted time. Now, being in Washington, I have to start with the appropriate caution. These are almost all investigational imaging methods, not all of them. I'm going to show you some very exciting results, but I'm not endorsing these as clinically effective tests, at least not at this point. So I think this is actually probably my most important slide. I want to spend just a little bit of time on it, and I think you'll see that this slide echoes Dr. Wolf's talk from yesterday, talking about what the imaging research goals are in the preoperative setting. So I have my timeline at the top, starting with diagnosis, my orange line of therapy here, and then looking, as we've heard throughout this conference, at pathologic response, especially CR, and then importantly looking at outcomes like disease-free survival and overall survival. My goal number one, and I'm just doing these along the timeline here, is really can we use imaging to do the kind of things we've been talking about doing from PATH, and that is to identify our targets, especially as we move towards targeted therapy, and or predict response. And a closely related goal number two is to be able to measure response very early, perhaps as early as a day or at least a few days or a week or two after the start of treatment. Now, actually, this may be more appropriately, especially when we're using these functional measures, thought of not as early response but perhaps as the pharmacodynamics of the treatment that we're doing. Now, one of the things that's come up in some of the past lectures is that when you look that early, that may not be entirely predictive of response. And very importantly, I think what we're trying to do here is not necessarily find the responders, but find the non-responders. If we can use these two front goals to help us better select our patient population and identify early who's not going to respond to the treatment we may have chosen, that's what we're after here. Now, as we move further down into the therapy and get towards the end of the therapy, we get to my goal number three, which is predict outcome. Much of the work that you've seen in imaging in the neoadjuvant setting is predicting the outcome of pathologic response. And as we've heard over and over again, a PCR is a very predictive outcome. But the hope here is that this in vivo functional imaging can not only get us as good as a PATH response, but when we start to look more importantly at more robust and downstream outcomes, that the imaging should add to what we already get from PATH-CR. And I'll show you at least one example of that in my talk. And then finally, perhaps with the most scientific goal, is we have these elegant in vivo tools. Can we use them to learn something about what happens in vivo to tumors as they get treated in this very unusual situation of preoperative chemotherapy where we have the tumor in place while the treatment is going on? So those are the goals, and those of you that made it back in the room for the slide, you'll now get the rest of the talk. Now, there's a number of different imaging modalities. There's CT, MR, both in magnetic resonance imaging and spectroscopy, my specialty, radionuclide imaging, ultrasound, and optical imaging. I'm really going to emphasize human imaging and emphasize functional imaging, so with all due respect to the CTographers, the ultrasonographers in the crowd, we're going to focus on the ones that are in yellow. So here's imaging 101. Okay, we've heard a lot about magnetic resonance imaging at this talk, and as you know, this creates a three-dimensional image related to the proton chemical environment. We can alter that environment using magnetic nuclei such as gadolinium and iron, and we can actually be very clever about our pulse sequence even in the absence of contrast and measure things like diffusion, which may be an indirect indication of cellularity. The capability is influenced by the field strength. This is a little bit like computer processing speeds. They get larger all the time. The latest clinical field strength is 3T. And in particular, I'm going to emphasize in this discussion something that you've heard about already, dynamic contrast enhanced MR, DCE MRI. These are the same curves you saw before from Dr. Partridge at our institution, who was one of Dr. Hilton's, our earlier speakers, postdoctoral fellows. And again, the idea is we get functional information here that complement the type of anatomic information we've heard about earlier. Now, the advantages of this technique is it has very high spatial resolution. It does not have a radiation dose, which is very nice. The disadvantage is that of all the imaging modalities, this is probably the most confined. If you've ever been in a magnet, it's a pretty tight space. It clangs a lot. People can get used to it, but it takes a little bit of doing. And then the contrast possibilities are somewhat limited by the choice of nuclei that we have for contrast. Now, if you take that same piece of machinery and then go back to your organic chemistry, and I realize for the non-chemist in the crowd that may create a few nightmares, but if you go back to your organic chemistry lab, you remember the idea of using the magnet as a spectroscopy device, and that is to be able to look at these signals to identify the chemical species and their concentration in the tissue. Now, if you thought that was a challenge with your little organic chemistry sample, it's actually even more of a challenge in the body. And so this is an area where the higher field strength makes a huge amount of difference. Now, this is a very elegant technique that does not require contrast, that allows us to look at a whole bunch of different molecules at the same time and measure their concentration with some regional capabilities. The disadvantage is that even with our very high magnets, it still has fairly limited spatial resolution. And if you thought it was a challenge to, you know, look at those spectra when you're in organic chemistry, imagine having a whole bunch of them and having to look at them quickly over many, many tissue planes and samples. So it is a challenging data analysis paradigm even in our current state of the art of computers. Now, when we talk about radionuclide imaging, we're thinking about single photon emission computed tomography, or SPECT, using such highly biologic nuclei as technetium and I-123, which limit to a certain extent what you can make. Now, positron emission tomography, or PET, uses positron emitters that come in flavors like carbon and fluorine, and because of that, we can actually have a very wide range of probes, which is really, I think, perhaps the key strength of PET as a technique. We get a 3D image of radionuclide concentration, and perhaps even more so than MRI, could get quantitative measures over time to look at kinetics through dynamic imaging. Now, this is a very sensitive technique. It needs very few molecules to generate the image, and so you really are operating under tracer conditions where you do not perturb the physiology that you're looking at, unlike most of the other imaging modalities. We can be quantitative, and again, especially with PET, we can have a very wide range of molecular probes. The problem here is we don't have a whole lot of spatial resolution. This is inherently limited in its spatial resolution in anatomy. The combination of PET and CT in the same device and a PET CT device helps a little bit, but doesn't completely overcome that. And there is some radiation dose. I did get a question about what the radiation dose is there. Actually, from the typical PET procedure, the radiation dose is less than diagnostic CT, but it's still a radiation dose, unlike some of the other modalities. And then finally, I'm going to briefly touch on optical imaging. Simply said, this uses the light that your eye can see, but in much more sophisticated ways than we've ever been able to do before. And we can use contrast agents, we can look at bioluminescence, we can do near-infrared spectroscopy, we can get very sophisticated as how we look at the light emanating from tissue. The advantages here is very portable, it's inexpensive, and this can actually be a bedside technique. It's minimally invasive, and it is possible to generate optical molecular contrast agents. So why is this not the modality that everybody's been using for the past 10 years? It has pretty limited tissue penetration, and some of the technology that's evolved has overcome that to a certain extent, but still remains one of its chief disadvantages. Now, one of the things I was asked to say is, what is the patient burden for a patient who's going to participate in an imaging research study as part of what she does in a neoadjuvant therapy trial? So you can see the imaging times vary, with perhaps PET and SPECT being the longest imaging times, but you can spend up to an hour in the magnet, more typically 15 to 30 minutes. And even some of the shorter tests will take some time. As I mentioned, there is a radiation dose associated with PET, and there is somewhat of a confined and highly magnetic field in the MRI, which makes life a little bit inconvenient at times, although we're getting better and better at that over the course of time. So let me now go through some examples where we're able to accomplish some of these goals in very early trials, pointing toward, I think, what the future will be. And we'll start with goal number one, to identify the target and predict response. Well, perhaps the oldest target in breast cancer is the estrogen receptor. And fortunately, with a PET isotope, fluorine-18, we can make fluoroestradiol, FES, which has properties very similar to estradiol. And this has been around for a while and has actually developed in a collaboration between Katzenella, Bogan, and Welch at the University of Illinois and at WashU. And I'm going to start in a little bit of reverse order. This is a paper from our center from my colleague Hannah Linden that was published in JCO last spring in the metastatic setting that took two patients with ER-positive primary tumors, one of which had evidence of FES uptake in a sternal recurrence, so black is hot. We're looking in coronal planes, just so you can get oriented here. And looking at the course of glucose metabolism as a measure of response, had a very nice and actually rather early response to hormonal therapy. Here's a patient on the bottom that has bone metastases from an ER-positive tumor, did not have an FES signal up, indicating an absence of the ER, and without the target, this therapy doesn't work, and she didn't respond to multiple hormonal therapies. Well, a number of years back, a study done by Mortimer, Dadashti, and colleagues at WashU had shown very similar results in a patient population getting primary tamoxifen therapy, including patients who were getting neoadjuvant tamoxifen therapy. And echoing the themes that I told you about at the front end, what they found is in everybody who is ER positive, they're all candidates for hormonal therapy, there was a subset of patients with low or absent uptake of the estradiol compound, and none of those responded to treatment. Not everybody with uptake responded, but importantly, we were able to identify a subset who did not respond and who really would not have, in a prospective study, might have been candidates who, for other types of treatment other than endocrine treatment. Now, this is an example of a study from Aberdeen. We've heard a lot about their work. This is from an article by Semple, and it's a little bit of a different approach. Here he's looking at the dynamic enhanced contrast enhancement, looking at a couple of parameters where most of these parameters relate to combinations of blood flow and permeability. And he was comparing that contrast enhancement map to an FDG PET taken pre-therapy and post-therapy. Now, in patient number one, he had a relatively under-perfused tumor that had a lot of metabolism, and with the hypothesis that perhaps the chemo just wasn't simply getting to that location, this patient did not respond very well. Patient number two has a relatively well-perfused tumor, not as metabolically active, but as you can see in the change of color over the course of time, this is a patient that responded. So for slightly different reasons, this pre-therapy study was predictive. By looking at the ratio between flow and metabolism, we found similar results in our center using a combination of PET agents. I'm going to move on to goal number two of measuring early response. And this is actually where there probably have been the most data and perhaps the most mature studies. I think the first of this came from FDG PET, fluorodeoxyglucose PET, the PET that you're used to seeing. In two articles published back in 2000 in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, both examining neoadjuvant therapy in locally advanced breast cancer and both using measures of sort of minimal versus gross residual disease, macroscopic complete response versus non-macroscopic complete response, and showed that after a single cycle of chemotherapy, they were able to see a significant difference between responders and non-responders that predicted what happened several weeks and months down later at the time of pathologic assessment. And in one case, the early time point was actually the best separation between the two curves, giving an indication that this may be a very early measure of who's not going to respond and with some prediction of who's going to respond. You've probably seen more recently a larger study confirming these results published by Rousseau recently in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. We're beginning to see some of these same things coming in more targeted agents where FDG, again, has been a very good predictor of early response, perhaps more appropriately early pharmacodynamics. You heard a lot about MRI in Dr. Hilton's talk. I won't dwell on this, but a recent study from Padani and colleagues in Middlesex, UK, who again looking at this transfer constant map, a measure that combines blood flow and permeability, showing that you see significant responses after one cycle that are predictive of outcome, at least in terms of a pathologic complete response. Now, I think one of the more exciting areas of work that have come along recently, the group at Minnesota, published a couple of years ago by Masami in Radiology, has shown by looking at magnetic resonance spectroscopy. So looking at the chemical species in the tumor over the course of time, you can see some very early changes, perhaps as early as a day. So this CHO represents the choline signal, the level of choline coming from the tumor, knowing that choline is associated with abnormal membranes and is a marker of the tumor. And what we can see as early as day one is a decrease in that choline signal. I dare you to try to read these spectra on your own. But we, computers and people that know what they're doing can actually look at this quantitatively over the course of time and see these changes actually quite a bit sooner than you see lesion diameter changes, which take a longer time to go on. Again, perhaps another metabolic biochemical evidence of seeing an early response long before we start to see size changes in those same processes. I mentioned the diffusion weighted MRI. Diffusion is a measure of the degree to which water molecules can flow freely through tissue. And in fact, when you have a very cellular tumor in the breast, that limits the diffusion and shows up as a decreased diffusion constant, often called the ADC. And this is an example from Dr. Jagannathan, and I'm probably mispronouncing his name, in New Delhi with a little bit of help from Bob Gillies in the University of Arizona, showing again early changes in diffusion, perhaps, and likely related to cellular dropout, making more room for water molecules to go through. Another technique to look for early responses, early decreases in cellularity as evidence of early response. And then finally, this is a slide from Bruce Tromberg at UCI, who's been working with Dr. Hilton at UCSF. And using a combination of MR and then importantly optical scanning, you can see this really is a bedside technique, showing some early changes in this case in the lipid content and in the total hemoglobin signal measured by optical imaging as a reflection of early response. So I want to move on now to goal number three and look at whether these functional in vivo measures can predict outcome. And again, we're not only going to look at the pathologic complete response, but the disease-free and overall survival as long-term endpoints. This is a paper from our center by my colleague Lisa Dunwald, published a couple of years ago in Cancer. We're using the molecule technetium-99M cestamibi, or MIBI. This was designed as a myocardial perfusion tracer, has been used in tumor imaging. It's actually approved for breast cancer imaging. And again, probably functions, at least with early uptake, largely as a tumor perfusing imaging agent. Now, we had previously shown by this, you can see in this example here, that the change in MIBI uptake, and in particular the residual MIBI uptake, correlated with the pathologic response. In this patient above, we see these many black dots in the breast and the axilla. That's not good. Those went away at 2 months, and that was a predictor of a pathologic complete response. Here's a patient whose black dots clearly got a lot better. We measure these quantitatively as well. But she had some residual uptake in the breast at 2 months and had residual gross tumor at the time of surgery. Now, the proof is in the pudding in terms of long-term outcomes. So with a later subsequent analysis, we looked at 62 patients. I forgot to put the N on the slide. And what we found is that high residual MIBI uptake as an indication of residual tumor perfusion, residual tumor vascularity, was predictive of a poor outcome, not only disease-free survival, but overall survival, which is actually rather challenging to predict in these studies. And I should mention that this was actually a study using patients who had largely gotten the metronomic chemotherapy regimen that Dr. Swain talked about yesterday, of the Ellis-Livingston regimen. So the question is, wow, this looks pretty interesting. These curves are, you know, small numbers, but look pretty rather predictive. How does that look when we compare this to other markers? Because the idea is that this is going to be additive. Well, in this relatively small series, we did see primary path tumor CRs being predictive, as we would expect. Ki-67 was predictive, as we would expect, and some trends for some of the other predictive variables. But we actually found rather a high degree of prediction based upon the two-month study, and even greater amount of prediction based upon the study that was done close to the end of treatment, close to the end of surgery. These hazard ratios are small, but this brings to mind that these are continuous variables, and that's the hazard ratio per unit change in this variable. That's the power of the kind of continuous variables that you can get out of well-done imaging studies. So rather predictive in this early study, and in a multivariate model, retained a significant p-value, suggesting that the imaging data is giving you something more than simply a prediction of PCR, but this in vivo data is complementary to in vitro path data in terms of predicting outcome. Now, I hesitate to use the word surrogate outcome, perhaps especially after Dr. Wolf's talk yesterday, but I think you can begin to see that this kind of information can be very helpful in clinical trials in trying to get additional information, trying to identify the best way to treat patients. And then finally, I just wanted to show you one example of how these types of studies might help elucidate tumor biology, especially over the course of response. And again, this comes from our center, published by Jeff Tseng, one of our residents, who's now down working with the nuclear medicine group at Stanford. And we looked at glucose metabolism blood flow using a combination of two PET tracers, fluorodeoxyglucose, which you're familiar with, and O15 water, which actually gives you very nice measures of blood flow. And we have plotted both pre-therapy and post-therapy flow versus metabolism for a series of approximately 30 patients. Now, what I've drawn here in this dashed line is what I would see if we had plotted out the normal breast. Because remember, most tissues are actually pretty well coupled in their metabolism and blood flow. That's sort of how the body works. It tends not to waste nutrients and waste blood flow. And if I were to plot the normal breast, you'd see them lining up along a nice straight line down here, and I've just extrapolated that over the course of time. Now, unlike normal tissues, the tumors were not at all coupled. Especially in the locally advanced breast cancer setting pre-therapy. And in fact, most of them had deviated significantly away from this line where they were overusing glucose. They were a lot more glycolytic than one would expect per unit blood flow that they were measuring. And very interestingly, what we saw is a move towards this line post-chemotherapy and actually a much closer coupling between metabolism and blood flow after the institution of chemotherapy. Now, the next slide's a little bit complex, so I'll walk you through it. But this is that same set of data grouping patients by no response, pathologic complete response, and then a partial response showing some change in time, course over the time of tumor. So there's a couple of very interesting observations. Number one is, if I look at where these patients start, the non-responding patients started furthest away from this axis in that point where they have a lot of metabolism per unit blood flow, going back to the data from Semple that I showed you before. So even before we start, that physiology looks predictive. And very interestingly, the responders are moving down towards that axis and getting to the point of looking like they have both decreased blood flow and metabolism and moving towards the line of matching for the normal breast. Now, here's where I think it gets very interesting. The non-responders who did not have a change in size actually had some average decrease in metabolism. They were moving towards more normal glucose metabolism, but they had an increase in vascularity. So this tumor is trying to move towards a more normal metabolic environment, but it's doing it at the expense of vessel creation, increased blood flow, and that may actually be rather detrimental to the patient's long-term outcome, as I just showed you. So this has been a hypothesis-generating exercise for us, because we've now hypothesis that when we look at an imbalance between substrate use and delivery, and we look at aberrant metabolism, that's a stress response. Same kind of stress response occurs in the heart that's ischemic. And that stress response for the tumor is a way of having the tumor cells avoid death, just like a heart trying to save itself. And this may be actually identifying a rather resistant tumor. Now, in the process of chemotherapy, even in the absence of response, there's a decrease in metabolism. But in those tumors with less favorable responses, there's actually an increase in blood flow. Gets us back towards more balanced metabolism, they may actually respond. But the question is whether we pay the price for this angiogenesis, for this increased blood flow, in terms of recurrence and metastases. So I'll conclude there. And I think I actually did manage to keep on my time. But hope to convince you that this is a very exciting area of research. It's quite complementary to the type of work that we've seen before. There's a variety of modalities. I've left some out, and I apologize to those for whom I've missed your favorite modality. But they are very good not only for measuring size, but for measuring biochemical, functional, and molecular processes. Our goals are clinical endpoints, but somewhat different clinical endpoints than we may have been used to using for imaging. And then I hope I've at least begun to convince you that we can get some unique biologic insights that look at the in vivo biology of a treated tumor. And then importantly, I think you can link this back pretty quickly to the talks you saw before the break and show how this in vivo clinical imaging can link us back to laboratory findings and vice versa and really create a very nice environment for translational research. So I thank you again.
I'd like to welcome Matthew Ellis, who I think is a professor in the Department of Medicine at WashU, the vice chair of the Breast Committee for CALGB, and the chair of medical oncology for ACOSOC. He's versatile.
Thank you very much. So I'll try and keep on time, too. Is that right? Okay. So I have an interesting topic to discuss, and this issue of window opportunity studies and what we may learn from them. Let me see. There you go. Well, the definition of a window of opportunity studies, it would be one where there's a relatively brief exposure to an intervention with no real therapeutic intent, as opposed to a preoperative treatment strategy where the idea is to shrink the tumor. Of course, there are studies which are sort of hybrids between the two. You've shown some elegant examples of that from Professor Dowsett this morning, where he combines a window study with using a two-week biopsy, and then the patient stays on that therapy for therapeutic intent. Now, in general, why would we want to conduct window studies? I thought of four areas to discuss. There's probably others. One interesting idea that you could study potential chemoprevention agents in this setting of the perioperative environment where you could get a pre- and post-treatment sample to try and demonstrate that a given chemoprevention agent might have relevant biological effects. Secondly, you might be able to use a window study to identify tumor resistance or sensitivity profiles, and I'll show you some examples of that. A third might be a demonstration of proof of principle with respect to a biological agent, showing it has an expected mechanism of action. And then finally, you might even use it as a drug development strategy. For example, having defined a target, you could define a dose that actually effectively inhibited that target, this concept sometimes referred to as biologically effective dose. But there are a lot of problems, practical constraints, for no therapeutic intent study, and perhaps particularly for these window studies. First of all, there are ethical and practical difficulties of conducting studies where there's no expected patient benefit. Of course, one is also restricted to non-toxic agents, or relatively non-toxic agents, in this setting of curative breast cancer surgery, so that you need a very well-established toxicity profile. There are complex issues regarding logistics of sample collection and consent, which I'll discuss. And then, of course, you're relying on the tissue to give you your answer, so you need robust surrogate endpoints, which have some meaning with respect to clinical outcomes, and that's one of the larger barriers that we face in these studies. What are you actually measuring, and what does it mean? And then finally, the surgical setting may present some special difficulties with certain agents, for example, perhaps anti-angiogenesis agents. So examples of studies assessed in window studies, and I do apologize, there are quite a few of these in the literature, and I've just picked out just one or two to make some points. But there's been some fairly extensive work with endocrine agents because, of course, they have relatively low short-term toxicity. There's been some study of dietary components. There have been studies that are in planning or being considered with drugs that have sort of incidental anti-cancer activity that might have prevention value, like COX-2 inhibitors and perhaps statins. And then finally, there's beginning to be some work on signal transduction inhibitors, particularly those that have a very well-established toxicity profile. This kind of study using window of opportunity would not be appropriate for something that's very early on in its clinical profile. So first of all, discuss this issue of using the setting to study potential chemoprevention agents, and this just illustrates for me some of the barriers. Vera Stearns here is in the audience, and if Anne Gallagher was here, I'd also point her out to you as someone who actually screened a very large number of patients, 267, for a pyrrolidone alcohol study. Pyrrolidone alcohol was hypothesized to be a provincial chemoprevention agent. It actually can be found in lavender oils, and it has a relative in the skins of citrus fruits called limonene. And these have been shown in various rat models to prevent the induction of breast cancer. And so the idea was, could you demonstrate biological effects of pyrrolidone alcohol in a window of opportunity study? So in order to find a relatively small number of patients who actually received this drug, maybe 20 patients or so, we had to screen 267 patients. The reason for non-participation are given on the right-hand side and included ineligibility, no response to the study coordinator, difficulties with scheduling, patients who declined. That was actually a relatively small number, and miscellaneous logistical problems. So if you're going to do window of opportunity studies, you have to have a whole sort of setup to get at patients and discuss the study with them early in the course of their workup. And during the course of this issue, this early window study, we came across a number of issues. One was the potential for patient harm in the early disease setting. So we had to do a sort of phase one dose escalation approach to make sure that patients would actually tolerate the medication in the perioperative setting. There was issues regarding the discussion of research with patients who were experiencing a high level of distress due to a recent diagnosis of breast cancer. It's not the best moment to discuss clinical research with patients. And then 30 was an interesting issue that also came up, was that if the patients entered the pyrrolidone alcohol study, there was a question of whether they were subsequently eligible for cooperative group adjuvant studies, and so that needs to be addressed too. One of the logistics problems we confronted was that the whole idea of this study, we would use existing pathological material. So there was no dedicated tissue accrual. All our assays were based on form and fixed materials. And we included patients who needed a re-excision, not all of whom had material when they ultimately went to surgery for a second time. And so as a result, we found that our ability to get paired tissue before and after the the intervention was somewhat limited, and that really restricted our ability to study our surrogates. So one of the things I did when I went to Duke was to look at the idea of whether you could get frozen tissue at the time of diagnostic biopsy. So in other words, everyone would be approached at the time that the radiologist or the surgeon was taking tissue for diagnosis and say, well, take some extra cores that would be then frozen and could be potentially used for research. This approach required a system of so-called abeyance pathology, where these samples are put on one side, and if the pathologist feels that a diagnosis can't be made with a routine cause, those abeyance samples then become part of the pathology record and they're analyzed too. So for example, this happened when the standard course didn't show any cancer. And interesting, every time we did this, the abeyance cause also did not show any cancer. But what you can show, if you have a good system for doing this, is you can actually get frozen tissue through abeyance pathology in a very large number of cases, and you get high-quality cores as well. You can see here for T1 tumors, N85, we're able to get up to 4 average cores per patient for research, and most of these had at least one core with 60% cancer. And I think as the tumor size went up, we got to a point where almost all patients had a sample. And so this is also obviously of great value in the setting of standard neoadjuvant therapy, because if you have a system in place like this, you don't have to ask the patient for a research core. You already have one. The other issue was getting the post-treatment sample at lumpectomy. And John Olson developed this device where the lumpectomy specimen, when it comes out of a patient, the routine thing to do is a specimen mammogram. And John developed this device that holds the lumpectomy specimen, allows you to take core biopsies. And we actually challenged the pathologists to see if they could see which ones we'd actually called for research and which ones hadn't been subject to this. And they actually could never tell which ones we'd actually taken little bits of tissue out for research. So increased the number of patients in which you got paired before and after frozen material for window studies. And this just shows what you can do with this biopsy device in this relatively small experience when the biopsy device was used on the lumpectomy specimen versus not. It really increased the number of patients who had a cancer-rich core quite substantially, because you can, using the image you get, you can place the core needle right in the middle of the lumpectomy specimen where the tumor is. So how about using a window of opportunity, or let's just say tissue surrogates for identifying tumor resistance and sensitivity profiles? And here, the best data comes from the endocrine therapy field. Like Mitch, we've been working on Ki-67 as both a surrogate endpoint biomarker, but also PD marker or pharmacodynamic marker. And in this study that compared neoadjuvant letrozole and tamoxifen, as I think everyone appreciates now, the aromatase inhibitor produced superior clinical response rates. But in the course of this study, we also developed a concept of cell cycle complete response. So the idea here is that ER-positive tumors, as we've learned, relatively uncommonly undergo PATH-CR, even with chemotherapy, and certainly very rarely with endocrine therapy. So was there something in the post-treatment sample that we could use that would have similar properties to pathological complete response? So we alighted on the idea of a tumor in which the Ki-67 staining had essentially gone away, 1% or less. And you can see here in this slide, in fact, when you're comparing letrozole and tamoxifen, relatively small number of cases, but statistically speaking, more underwent cell cycle complete response with letrozole than tamoxifen. And in fact, this measure was more sensitive than the other measurements in terms of discerning the difference between these two drugs. So how good is cell cycle complete response in terms of predicting long-term outcome? So this is an interesting slide. It's preliminary data, so I want you to treat it that way. But it essentially shows something very similar to what Dr. Dowsett showed earlier. These are patients who, in their surgical sample, the Ki-67 is 1% or less, so they've undergone a cell cycle complete response. and these are patients who have a key 67 value above that level. And what you can see here in this overall survival plot, that patients who have very low post-treatment key 67s have a superior survival. Now, I'd like to point out something interesting here. This is from the letrozole arm of the P024 study. All these patients received adjuvant tamoxifen, not letrozole. So this, and in fact, counter to what you might have thought, this predictability of the 1% cutoff worked much better on the letrozole arm than on the tamoxifen arm. So it would seem that this estrogen deprivation test is quite predictive for long-term outcome, even when the patients receive tamoxifen. Now, we have been taking advantage of this concept of the key 67 data to try and find new markers for endocrine therapy resistance. And the reason for this is that we've been looking at letrozole, effect of letrozole on proliferation by HER2 status. And what we found is that tumors that are HER2, ER positive and HER2 gene amplified very rarely undergo what we call this cell cycle complete response. Almost all of them are showing letrozole resistant proliferation. Whereas the majority of tumors that have that don't have gene amplification, in fact, do undergo a good response, and most of them showing very little key 67 by the time they go to surgery. And this finding that ER-positive tumors that have HER2 gene amplification tend to have high post-treatment proliferation levels exactly mirrors what you see in the adjuvant setting, that is to say that these ER-positive, HER2-positive tumors do have a higher event rate compared to those that are ER-positive, HER2-negative. And this is true whether the patients receive tamoxifen or letrozole. But you can see that HER2 gene amplification is a minor player in the problem of endocrine therapy resistance. There's many more tumors that are HER2 negative that nonetheless are having problems with post-treatment proliferation. So what are those other events that drive proliferation that's estrogen deprivation resistance? And we've started a comprehensive approach to this problem, essentially using the tumor analysis as a screen for genetic events that drive aromatase inhibitor resistant proliferation. And in this screen, obviously, we measure the Ki-67 before and after treatment. It probably doesn't matter too much whether it's the 2-week or the 3 or 4 months. In fact, Mitch just told me that his 4-month Ki-67 analysis is just as predictive as relapse-free survival as the 2-month. As a 2-week. So the point is that these tumors can grow independent of estrogen, which is not what you'd expect of a fully responsive ER-positive tumor. The genetic screen is based on whole genome transcriptional analysis and array CGH, because our primary hypothesis is there's other amplicons that can drive estrogen-independent proliferation. And we've also started some target gene resequencing, and we do IHC with phosphoprotein-specific antibodies to interrogate pathways. Now, the array CGH is beginning to show some rather interesting things. It's remarkable how complex the breast cancer genome is, and currently we're tracking about 35 separate amplicons in ER-positive breast cancer for impacts on Ki-67. I show you these slides to illustrate to you that here's the HER2 gene, here's the HER2 amplicon. You can see it's relatively rare compared to other amplicons. For example, the chromosome 8 rearrangement. This is a particularly interesting one at 8p11.1 and 8p11.2. I haven't got time to go into it, but this has recently been shown to be potentially associated with the lobular carcinomas. So you would expect it to be enriched in this population of locally advanced ER-positive tumors. The problem, of course, with any kind of correlation has been reiterated many times this morning, is sample size. We need to get to large sample sizes in order to overcome the problem of multiple testing to show that these amplicons are associated with poor Ki-67 response and, by corollary, poor long-term outcome. So to jack up our sample size, we initiated this study with ACOSOG. Is comparing three aromatase inhibitors, which is a perfectly reasonable clinical question to say, is there one that should be favored over the others with respect to neoadjuvant treatment? These aromatase inhibitors do differ in mechanism of aromatase inhibition as well as potency. So we are asking whether there's a difference here. But also, of course, we're able to get the frozen material we need to do these sophisticated analyses. And this trial is actually going quite well. We're just about to reach that magical 20% a cruel rule that CTEP uses to demonstrate that a particular study is viable. So additional studies have been done, for example, to demonstrate a new biological agent has the expected mechanism of action. And here I want to show you a few slides from Carlos Arteaga, just because it illustrates this point. And he's able to take patients who have early-stage breast cancer and give them actually a relatively toxic drug, alotinib. These patients had quite a lot of skin rash. Nonetheless, we owe these patients our gratitude, or at least the breast cancer community does, because this was actually allowing Carlos to really study whether this drug might have the kinds of anti-breast cancer activities we'd like to see. Now, it's a HER1 inhibitor. So he wanted to demonstrate that in breast cancer it would actually inhibit the relevant pathway. And so he's measuring multiple components of this pathway. I'll just show you one or two of his slides. What he's able to show, for example, that this is HER1, phospho-HER1, and he can switch off phospho-HER1 with alotinib in this particular patient, so that's showing that the target is appropriately hit by the kinase inhibitor. Interesting, alotinib also inhibits phospho-HER2. Although it's in vitro, it's a selective HER1 inhibitor, in vivo is actually able to inhibit HER2 phosphorylation as well, and actually has quite strong anti-proliferative effects. So I think the jury's still out as to whether HER1 inhibition is an important thing to consider for breast cancer treatment. And then finally, this concept of whether you can extend this idea further to establish biologically effective doses, either of chemoprevention agents or biologics. And there's a lot of interest in this. I'd guide you to have a look at this review in Nature Reviews Cancers on the concept of phase zero trials, where patients, in this case, they were largely considering the advanced disease setting, but you could also, with the right agent, do this in the perioperative setting, basically using tissue surrogates to establish a dose and to establish that the appropriate target is being inhibited. This paper is also very important. There's lots of other. We've used this word robust extensively during the course of this symposium, but I'd also introduce you concepts of accuracy, dynamic range, precision, reproducibility, and sensitivity. And actually, Mitch was discussing some of these issues with respect to his Ki-67 data. And I'd actually also like to take this slide to emphasize that I don't think Ki-67. Post-treatment Ki-67 is ready for prime time. I think that we need to develop a very robust assay before we do that and incorporate Ki-67 data into patient decision-making. But I think it definitely could be done, and we should consider it. So the idea then, ultimately, is that instead of the usual drug development paradigm where you try a drug in a mouse, the tumor shrinks in the mouse, and then you give it to a random a population of patients in a phase one study, and then you sort of expand your sample size, hoping that you can find a subpopulation of patients who are going to respond. Here you do something much smarter, which is actually you understand the mechanism of action of drug, you understand the target, you show you can inhibit that target in phase zero trials at the appropriate dose, and then you go into phase two in the right population of patients whose tumors express the target at the right dose, and then you may even, in sort of orphan drug indications, go straight to approval even without doing a phase three trial. So my conclusions are that window of opportunity studies are feasible but remain challenging, but there are ways around the problems. The clinical barriers are determined by the intent of the study, the nature of the agent, and the sample size. And most of our window trials have woefully inadequate sample sizes, so I was very impressed by the poetic study design because I think actually a sample size of thousands will probably be necessary. And then finally, the scientific barriers are determined by the quality of the biomarker analysis and the mechanism of action of the agent. Thanks a lot.
So our very next speaker is Don Burry. He's chair of the Department of Biostats and Applied Math at MD Anderson. He is as well a statistician on the breast committee of the CLGB. Don is going to talk about statistical considerations in pre-op trials. Thank you. Is this a note for me?
It's a note for you. Thank you. There are some people who think statistics is the most exciting part of a conference such as this. Unfortunately, none of them are here. My charge was to talk about statistical considerations, and I wanted to dispense with my charge in one slide and then talk about something I hope will be mildly exciting, at least. The sample size considerations for a dichotomous endpoint are standard, whatever the endpoint. So if you want to improve a response rate from 20% to 40%, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about metastatic disease or PCR, the statistical issues are the same. In the metastatic setting, the response is, of course, somewhat different and much more problematic because we don't measure at a particular time. Look at, after 6 weeks, after 12 weeks, et cetera, and at some point we register that there's a response. And time to response, or the fact that you haven't responded but haven't progressed by 6 months, is important. We never consider such things. We probably should. Indeed, in the metastatic setting, response is just one part of the continuum of progression and stable disease. Some of the same issues arise in the neoadjuvant setting. So here's my outline. I want to tell you about adjuvant trials and ask the question, are they still viable? They're getting huge for good reason. It raises the issue of, isn't there something better, like, for example, neoadjuvant trials? I want to discuss, with deference to Antonio and others, the issue of surrogacy. I will define surrogacy from a regulatory setting, and after I do that, I hope that we never use the word again. I'll talk about modeling, you know, something that we don't do very well in cancer, and indeed in medical research generally, is model the patient. You know, what happens to the patient over time? We'd ought to be looking at PCR. We'd ought to be looking at imaging, doing biopsies when and if we can. We'd ought to be looking at the relationship between the early endpoints and the later endpoints. And I'll give you an example of that. And finally, a little on the fine-tuning of PCR. So here, CLGB node positive studies in 1975, comparison of, among other things, a comparison of CMF with CMFVP, 800-some patients, 900-some patients in a study designed 5 years later, a very complicated design comparing at some course in the treatment, CMFVP with VATH, you know, five drugs versus four other drugs. In retrospect, we didn't learn much about individual drugs, but that's another story. CLGB 8541, designed 5 years later, sample size getting bigger. 8 years later, 9344, this is the Taxol three doses of Adriamycin study. Sample size even bigger. Now, these are node-positive patients where we expect a reasonable number of events. And in fact, we've come to learn that whatever number of events we expect, we don't get. And for good reason, the disease is changing, the treatment is changing, the prognosis is getting better and better and better for those who are detected. We targeted 1,800 events in this study. There were interim analyses after 450, 900, and 1,350. The study was supposed to be to close and be announced 3 years after the last patient accrued in 1997. It is now 10 years after that, and we still are not at the third interim analysis point. Luckily for the profession and patients, we announced the data a long time ago. That's disease-free survival. This is survival, same sort of thing. Not quite as extreme, but extreme nonetheless. Showing increasing benefit over time because screening mammography, stage shift associated with it, even within stage 2 disease, the introduction of tamoxifen, and of course the improvements in chemotherapy. So things are getting better and better. In the ATAC trial, a 9,000-patient trial that we've heard about here, and something bad happened on the way to the thing. So I guess you're not going to get... So let me tell you what that is. If you look at the picture from the original publication, it shows three curves that are that far apart with a highly statistically significant difference. And of course, the disease-free survival curves are very high, above 90% for most of the duration. They then showed, they magnified it so that you could see the difference between the curves. And what this thing up here is, the 10 days, was the difference over the 3.5-year period between anastrozole and tamoxifen. Several points about that. The main one is that the sample size is huge and that we're looking for smaller and smaller benefits. So is there potential for more sensitive and earlier comparisons? And the neoadjuvant setting provides a very neat example of that. So I want to revisit Aman Buzdar's trial that he told you about just to make one point. This was, he already explained it. The design was 164 patients, randomized equally, no interim analyses, but the data monitoring committee analyzed the data after 34 patients. I think Aman showed you something like 39 patients. But after 34 patients, these were the response rates, PCR rates. We said, especially in view of the slow accrual, it was accruing at about 2 patients per month, we know the answer. We did a calculation saying, given these data, what is the probability that after 164 patients we'll have statistical significance? And the answer was 95%. We said, this is enough. We know the answer. Of course, the precision associated with the estimates is nowhere near what it would be eventually, but we don't want to wait another 8 or 9 years to publish these results. And so the data monitoring committee opened it up and, it was presented at ASCO and JCO. So here's the chronology. Thousands of patients on trastuzumab treated in the metastatic setting and 12,000 patients treated in the adjuvant setting. And the teeny Buzdar trial in between with 34 patients, admittedly a different endpoint, but kind of a link between the metastatic endpoints and the adjuvant endpoints, and of course small. What about PCR? It's wonderful statistically. It's wonderful because, for several reasons, one is that it's at a fixed time. So it's not like in metastatic disease where we say a patient responded at some time during the course of therapy. It happens at a fixed time, at least within treatment group. It's early. And the early aspect means that we can take advantage of what we learn. So it's wonderful for being adaptive. It's wonderful for building a sleek design that addresses questions that arise, that validates them, and gets on with looking at other things. PCR should be fine-tuned along the lines of Fraser-Simmons, reducing the dichotomy into, how much of a CR is it. or how much of a response is it? But is it a surrogate for anything that's of clinically relevant? So the regulatory attitude towards surrogacy is the Prentice criterion. Prentice criterion is a response variable for which a test of the null hypothesis of no relation to the treatment groups, and stress that, under comparison is also a valid test of the corresponding null hypothesis based on the true endpoint. Now, only a statistician can write that. And if I were to ask you, what the hell does it mean? Roughly, it means that if you tell me the PCR difference between the two, you don't have to tell me anything else. You don't have to tell me what the disease-free survival was, that I know the answers. I know whether the treatment is effective. Roughly speaking, it says that the clinical endpoint and PCR is perfectly correlated. That's not exactly true, of course. The requirement is not quite that strong, but it's pretty strong. It's a very high hurdle. PCR clearly does not qualify. Excuse me. And we've seen that in the conference so far. But it's useful nonetheless. And I want to give you an example of its usefulness. This is using neoadjuvant therapy in drug development, and it's being adaptive. So there are two things that are going on. One is we're doing something revolutionary in medicine, medical research. We look at the data, and we adapt to what we're seeing. The other is, in the neoadjuvant setting, as opposed to the adjuvant setting, we've got something to look at, namely whether the patient experienced, whether the tumor was a pathologic complete response. So this is, in a way, a rather simple adaptive design. I didn't want to burden you with the more complicated kinds of things that we do. This is a seamless phase two design, where the phase two aspect is trying to see if there's a signal, and if there PCR mostly, but the primary endpoint is disease-free survival, and we're modeling the relationship between the two. So the phase two aspect is going to be a small number of centers accruing, and the only difference between phase two and phase three is that in phase three we expand to a larger number of centers. All the while, we're observing the relationship between PCR and disease-free survival, and we're by treatment group, and we're validating that the relationship that we see. One of the problems about surrogacy is it has to be true for all treatments. What we're doing is we're focusing on and we know that that's certainly not even close to being true with PCR. So I say standard approach. Of course, it's not the standard approach. The standard approach is we do phase two trials in metastatic disease and then take it into other metastatic disease populations and primary cancers. But we're moving toward, and we certainly could do what most of drug development does, namely have an early endpoint in the phase two part and then a later, more clinically relevant endpoint in the phase three part. It's dumb. It's incredibly dumb. We find that we have an effect on the phase two endpoint and no effect on the phase three endpoint. Surprise. What we'd ought to be doing is looking at everything at the same time and trying to understand the more important question, is there an effect on the clinically important endpoint, in this case, disease-free survival? So in the standard approach, if you observe a sufficient PCR rate, you may say, yahoo, let's go to phase three, and if you observe a disease-free survival advantage, you market your drug and everybody's happy. If you don't, then you find another job. If there's a low PCR rate, do you stop accrual? And in between, there's this white space for, I don't know, analyzing the data, deciding what you're going to do. The total development time from phase two to the end is 7 years, maybe more than that. In a seamless phase two, three that I'm going to describe, and there are particular assumptions that I've made that I won't tell you, but relatively the same sort of thing will apply. That is, if you're looking at a smaller advantage, the same comparisons will apply. So in the seamless phases, you start out at a few centers, like 15 patients per month, comparing equally randomized experimental and control. If the predictive probabilities look good, so what you do is you say, here I am today, what is the probability that experimental therapy will be shown to be better than control therapy? And if that gets to be, you know, moderate, not huge, but moderate, so that there's a reason to continue, then you expand into phase three and, let's say, start accruing. You open up other centers. Presumably the paths have been greased, the IRB paths have been greased in advance, and you accrue, in this example, 60 patients per month. The maximum sample size is 180. This is a single trial. All patients in the trial count for the final analysis, which is disease-free survival. You can stop early if the predictive probabilities of statistical significance are low. You stop for futility. Presumably, that would mean that you're not seeing much, if anything, on PCR rate, and you're getting some information, not much, but some information about how PCR rate relates to disease-free survival. That information will be treatment-specific. And the most important patients for that are the phase two patients, the ones that came in early because there's longer follow-up. Kind of an irony is that we run phase two on patients who have less follow-up than would be possible for phase, we run phase three on patients that have less follow-up than the better, longer follow-up in phase two. We use predictive probabilities to switch to phase three if, as I said, they look good. We can stop accrual for superiority and continue follow-up for some period of time or for futility. So in comparisons, I want to compare this design with the standard design or conventional design, and I use two conventional designs. One has four analyses total, three interim analyses, and a final analysis. The other has 18, and the reason I chose 18 is because it's the maximum number in the Bayesian analysis. We look every 2 months at the data and do predictions and decide whether we're done yet or we want to expand accrual. And, of course, we can be done by being a positive or a negative. And all three of these designs have the same significance level and the same statistical power. This is the expected number of patients in the Bayesian adaptive design that's using PCR rate, modeling with disease-free survival, the two conventional treatments under the null hypothesis. Now, I say the null hypothesis. There are lots of null hypotheses. They all look like this. One null hypothesis is that your drug has no effect on PCR. And PCR has no effect on survival or on disease-free survival. Another, a la B27, is that your drug does have an effect on PCR, but PCR doesn't translate into a survival benefit in the treatments. So in any of those null hypotheses, there's about a savings of a half. This is a random number. It could be as big as 1,800, but most of the time, it's very low. Under an alternative hypothesis, this is a success. There's a 25% improvement in disease-free survival in the experimental therapy, and again, there are many ways that that can happen. modulated through PCR or not, and the savings is not quite as great, but it's substantial nonetheless. Advantages, there are fewer patients in the trial. There's no hiatus for setting up phase three. All patients are used in the phase three endpoint, and all patients are used for modeling the relationship between PCR and disease-free survival. N is seldom near its maximum, but when it is, it's necessary. There are many trials, I shouldn't say many, but lots of trials that end, and you look at the data and you say, gee, I don't know the answer. Doesn't mean that you don't know the answer you would like to have known. You don't know whether the drug is effective or not, and you'd like to have continued. It is in those situations that you go to the maximum, and it's in those situations that you get the additional power. Two reasons for the advantages. One is exploiting the PCR and its potential predictability. It's potential. It's a correlate, maybe. Maybe it's not related at all. And if it's not, you learn that, and presumably then you have to go to the end. If it is related, you learn that, and you get to take advantage of it. Forget this surrogacy business. Ask, is it helpful? Is it going to tell me something that's going to allow me to make an earlier decision and to build a more efficient clinical trial? And the other is this, you know, looking frequently and asking, where am I going? Further improvements are possible in the neoadjuvant setting. Laura Esserman's I-SPY 2 is an example of that. Using biomarkers at baseline, potentially at biopsy when you get tissue, if those are possible. Using imaging, incredibly important, and we've heard about some of that in this meeting. And let's get into the current century. Let's start looking at more drugs. I mean, this is, you know, 50 years ago we got drugs by squeezing tree roots. Now there are other ways to get drugs, and we'd ought to take advantage of the drugs that are out there, not have this huge queue. There's false negatives and false positives and false neutrals, not looking at them. And so using drugs and drug combinations, I mean, as many as 10 drugs in the same trial or the same process with various combinations. It's not impossible. We've got to do it. We've got to be building a personalized medicine ability within clinical trials. And possibility of adaptive randomization. So not only do you stop arms and add arms, but you might discount arms in terms of how much probability you give them, because even they're not off the shelf yet. We're still learning about them, but things are not looking as good. So that's my outline. I told you about why we have to stop doing adjuvant trials, and maybe neoadjuvant trials are the solution. PCR is a correlate, potentially, certainly not a surrogate. We've got to model not only PCR and disease-free survival and overall survival, but any other things that come up along the way, like, for example, sera, and we've got to be fine-tuning PCR. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. I'd next like to introduce Dr. Joanne Zajewski, who's head of breast cancer therapeutics at the Clinical Investigations Branch at CTEP. Welcome, Joanne, or maybe you've welcomed us.
Yes. I'm really happy to be able to participate in this conference, and I will try to keep it under 11 minutes if I can, because I know everyone's going to be hungry. And one of the advantages of coming last on a scientific program, in a formal presentation, is that a lot of what I do have to say has been presented very eloquently beforehand. So the talk that I was going to give, I'm not going to give. And I'm going to bring up some points of sort of where we go from the future, basing on what we have seen this last few days. Now, I'll need to figure out.
Keyboard or the left button?
Left button.
And it's randomized.
Okay. I have to start with a disclaimer because I work for the National Cancer Institute and the government, but this isn't U.S. government work per se. You know, my opinions are my own opinions as a person working in the field, and they're not meant to be representative of the U.S. government. And I wanted to say that so that no one comes up with, well, you said we should do this, where's the money? I shouldn't say that, but it's true. Okay, considerations for future research. I wanted to address four issues. One is, what is the problem we are trying to solve? And in this, I'm going to go back to some of the opening talks we had with Dr. Wood and Dr. Hortabaji. The second thing is, what are we doing today? And that's just going to be a brief review, again, of everything, oh, not everything, but of some of the things that you've heard over the next 2 days, the immediate next steps, and then the big picture. So the first question is, what is the problem we're trying to solve? And it really is one of personalized medicine. You know, we're trying to tailor therapy, the right treatment, to the right person. And that's a lofty goal. I think it's an achievable goal. It's going to take us a while to get there. But I think Dr. Wood did a little bit more better of a job in outlining specific goals that we can look at. Because it's one thing to say personalized medicine. It's another to say, well, what do we mean by that? And I really liked this hierarchy. No occurrence of the cancer, no evidence of having had breast cancer, no evidence of having had treatment for breast cancer, no acute toxicity of the therapy, and no late sequelae of the therapy. Because this really is the clinical end of things. So sometimes we get all caught up in understanding the biology, which is extremely important, in trying to image and know a particular patient, that even if we can detect a PCI or increase the PCR, we don't know if we're really going to achieve one of the goals on this. And so I think it's important with every trial that we do to make sure that we're really thinking of the outcome on a clinical end. And it's a little easier for this audience since we're all in the clinical research area. This is a slide that you've all seen in Middlesex Hospital, and I wanted to show it so that we can review sort of where we've been over the past few decades. And what it shows is patients who didn't receive any specific treatment for their breast cancer. It was a select series over, you know, about 100 years, I think, maybe not quite that long, where patients basically had supportive care for probably locally advanced and metastatic breast cancer. And the thing that we learn from here is it's, you know, some people can live a long time with their disease. So those patients potentially would be able to be cured by surgery alone and mastectomy. And our goal was to push this curve, if you will, up to what a normal survival would be, which is the top curve. Now, this is a slide I use from Soon, and I think it's really helpful because it points out how we got where we are today, and we really are in a good place. So people who had no surgery had a survival curve that's modeled there. Mastectomy would cure some. Chemotherapy and hormonal therapy would cure others. Chemotherapy and hormonal therapy and targeted therapy would cure others. So we've been really focusing, drilling down hard on the no recurrence. And I think that's important. But each incremental step assumed that no patient is cured with the previous step. And that leads to the problem we have today, is that we have significant overtreatment, and there's a necessity to conduct large trials to demonstrate a small benefit. And I really want to talk about the overtreatment, because in the recent St. Gallen conference, they did a survey of people in the field on the web and wanted to know what the most important translational research objectives were. And the number one objective by far was identifying patients who don't need additional chemotherapy. So we're pretty convinced that we can tailor therapy for some people, and we have to make sure that we can do it by taking away other therapies and making sure we don't lose sight of the no recurrence of cancer. And that's very hard because the studies are very large, and taking away therapy is always harder than adding more therapy. But it really is where we are today, and this is just the price of our progress. Now, the next thing I wanted to talk about is really, what are we doing today? So this is just examples of the CTEP portfolio primarily. Not every study, because I can't do every study. But I wanted to say that concurrent with the a progress that we've been making in terms of adding incrementally small benefit, we've entered the age of molecular medicine and molecular profiling. And I think this is, as everyone knows, really important because we can address subtype-specific questions. And in a neoadjuvant setting in particular, we can select therapies for future research. Historically, we use the metastatic setting to select therapies that were promising to bring them into the adjuvant setting. And that paradigm still exists. But today, it's very difficult to tell what a phase 2 metastatic setting trial of response rate really means, because the patients, even if they're first-line metastatic, could have had between 0 and 4 or 5 prior chemotherapy regimens in the adjuvant setting. So it's no longer as helpful as it once was in determining, you know, some of the resistance patterns. And so I think using a neoadjuvant approach may be the one way that we're going to be able to select different therapies to go on to these confirmatory targets. And there's some risks in that that I'll talk about a little bit. And in all the trials, we have the discovery of targets. So I don't want to underestimate the value of looking at the biology of these particular tumors as we move forward. The first trial I wanted to mention was the ACOSAC trial. I look at this as a selection design. It does go on the goal of no recurrence of the cancer, but it's also trying to back off of no acute toxicity of the therapy, no late sequelae of the therapy, because the goal of this trial is to pick an AI, if there is one, that we can go against chemotherapy in a prospective randomized trial to try to safely back off. You know, that's one of the goals, not all of the goals. I think that this trial is possible because all these agents are commercially available. It wouldn't be possible to do this type of a trial very easily, if at all, when you're doing new agents that are more interesting, because people overinterpret these small results. So companies are not going to be that willing to put their agents against other companies' agents in a selection design because it's underpowered. But I wanted to bring that out because I actually think that would be very, very helpful for us as we move forward, being able to test new agents in a neoadjuvant setting, sort of that window approach. And unfortunately, some of the not all the agents are made by the same company, and they don't want to, you know, bank one agent against another. So that's more of a global issue we have to handle. The ACOSAC trial is, this trial is the trial that we have in the neoadjuvant setting for endocrine tumors. So this is a subtype of ER positive. The next subtype we're dealing with is HER2 positive, and this is the ACOSAC study. We've been over it twice before. But its goal really is no recurrence of the cancer, and it is also trying to back off from no acute toxicity of the therapy and no late sequelae of the therapy. And I think it's really interesting that the German group presented data with using trastuzumab and epirubicin concurrently with no apparent early safety signals. So I think this is an important observation that we might be able to make our therapy safer by different schedulings or even switching the chemotherapy. And obviously we're not there yet, but I do think it's an important study to follow up on. The next study that I want to talk about is the CLGB study with HER2 blockade that we'll be sponsoring. It's not yet finally approved in its protocol form, but it will be moving forward. And this one, in addition to the molecular markers, I think are really no recurrence of the cancer. You know, it may be that a tyrosine kinase inhibitor is going to work better than trastuzumab, a biologic, and be safer in terms of the heart. We really don't know that. In the third arm, where we're combining trastuzumab and lapatinib, we're definitely trying to decrease recurrences. And again, every time you do that, it sort of adds to toxicity. But I think this is an interesting study that I'm looking forward to see the answers of. And in the triple negative group, we've got a DNA damaging agent where the CLGB again is going to be using paclitaxel and randomizing to carboplatin versus not, and also looking at the bevacizumab, trying to look at biologics. And this study again is no recurrence of cancer. And this study I'm going to come back to again because we are using the neoadjuvant response sort of like a screening phase too. You know, if the carboplatin looks really promising in an early PCR response rate, the plan is to move forward in this population in a randomized clinical trial. And when I get to the big picture part of it, I want people to think about, are we really going to be able to accomplish that? Anti-angiogenesis is sort of a combination of chemotherapy and biologics. I added this because this is the NSABP B40 trial. It's an unselected population in terms of triple negative versus ER positive. They're looking at different chemotherapy regimens and along with bevacizumab. So I think this will be very helpful for predictive models, but it also helps us understand that we may not know the target, and we may not even know if we're targeting the blood or the tumor, but we still are going to be able to use the setting to develop predictive markers for outcome. And we have to be careful about the outcome we're trying to predict, which should really be disease-free or overall survival. Now, this, again, because it's adding on therapies, I think is a no recurrence of the cancer, primarily, along with the biology. All of these are the biology. And this is a cooperative group study, although it's not an NCI-sponsored study. It's the German group study. But I really do like the idea of seeing if we can use early response to therapy or early imaging, or as Dr. Berry talked, instead of I-SPY, to direct in an individual patient. And I don't know if that's going to be possible or not. But I like the design, and I think that's where we have to be heading, so we don't just keep incrementally adding. And this, again, I think is a setup for no recurrence of the cancer because they're picking a resistant group. So the next thing I want to talk about is the immediate next steps. So we have all this information. We've made a lot of progress. So where do we go from here? Well, the one thing that was pretty clear is we have to do it together. And I'm very excited to say that the Breast International Group, the Breast Cancer Intergroup, and the NSABP have been meeting over the past 2 years to try to coordinate our global efforts in breast cancer. And I think this is really a pivotal moment. It's an important moment. And amazingly enough, I shouldn't say this, but we really are getting some things done. And here's the first thing that we think we got done. We have to implement it now. But we did incorporate specimen collections, standard operating procedures. I'm not going to read this to you because it was presented in an earlier slide. It'll be webcast and video archive, so be able to look back at it. But what it says is we need to improve our diagnostics, and we need to do what we need to do today so that we can go back and look at these studies. And what the groups decided to do is at least at this point look at their own SOPs, append them to the protocols and try to move forward to this kind of an approach. And I think this is important because I suspect that the fastest way we're going to make progress is prospective validation of predictive factors in retrospective clinical trials. But that means you really got to bank, and you got to bank well, and you have to have robust assays. And this is, I don't know if Soon's still here, but he says, has said repeatedly, and I agree with it, that the diagnostic people have to develop technologies for the lowest common denominator, because we can do something really fancy in the lab, and I think that's great for drug discovery, and we can control a neoadjuvant setting, and we can get what we need to know for gene discovery, but if we're going to translate it, it's got to be easy. So we can say we want everyone to collect, you know, samples in a given way, but getting it to happen is a huge, you know, issue. The next thing I wanted to plug is our STEEP design, or STEEP, whatever, STEEP methodology. System, STEEP system. Cliff coined the name just over the weekend. I think it was Saturday. And what it is a standardized definitions for efficacy endpoints in neoadjuvant breast cancer trials. We've done this for adjuvant breast cancer trials. A group of us met over a year from all the, you know, all the North American groups. We had review by the international groups as well to try to standardize endpoints in the adjuvant setting. And that paper will be coming out. What we agreed to do on Saturday is standardize endpoints in the neoadjuvant setting. And what I have here is, I think from Dr. Hartabaji's talk, what a PCR is. In order to standardize endpoints so that we can look and do meta-analysis across trials, it's not even as easy as deciding which one of these four different opportunities would be a PCR. You've got to decide, you know, what is going to be the events that you're going to capture. Are you going to capture DCIS, how much DCIS, you know, are you going to measure the tumor size? Are you going to count the number of nodes you did? Is one single invasive cell going to be counted or not? You know, in an earlier talk, we had all the different ways you can measure PCR. So this group is just going to be starting, but we're going to tackle that. You know, we're going to define events. We're going to standardize terminology endpoints. And this will at least allow us to move forward where we're all talking about the same thing and using the same vocabulary. So that's another next step. Oops, what did I do wrong here? Okay, so the big picture. So the big picture is, oh, I must have clicked a bunch of times, is how do we get from pathologic complete response to changing practice? And I think this is actually, you know, a real challenge that we have to think of. And the first question, I don't have much to say here, is pre- or post-op sentinel lymph node biopsy. How can we answer this question? I mean, obviously, this is controversial. It's important because we don't know what to do with local therapies in today's treatment. Some people think someday we won't have to look at nodes because everything will be predicted in the primary tumor, so you don't actually need to do the sentinel node biopsy. But trying to think about how we can quickly, easily, feasibly answer this question, I think, is a challenge. So that's a challenge for the audience, one of the outstanding questions. The other outstanding problem we have to deal with is confirming surrogates in prospective studies of clinical outcomes. And I, when Don talked, I quick looked at my slides to see if I took out all the surrogates, and I didn't. I still have the surrogate in here. But I actually think this is what I'm trying to do, is PCR going to be a surrogate for anything, and if so, what? And I think we run into a real problem with early interpretation of results. So, for example, if we have an increased PCR rate in the triple negative trial, will people really randomize to a phase 3 adjuvant trial to go on the no platinum arm? And I think, you know, that's a problem, but it's necessary. You know, we know that platinum in the metastatic setting has a higher response rate. A Cochrane analysis has been done showing no improvement in progression-free survival in metastatic disease. There's a suggestion in a randomized control trial that in spite of really good evidence that in the preclinical models that platinum and trastuzumab are synergistic, a randomized trial in the metastatic setting did not show an improvement in the progression-free survival with the combination of taxane and trastuzumab and a platinum. So I want to be careful that we don't incorporate toxic therapies too soon without doing the randomized trials, while really understanding that because of our culture and the fact that we treat prognosis, that we're going to want to give these people the more is better. One of the potential questions I have behind that is, should we nest the neoadjuvant studies? And this truly is a question. You know, if you do a study where you have adjuvant and the same treatment, give either adjuvant or neoadjuvantly, you overcome some of the problems. You know, one is that there's less selection bias. There's still some because we select people we give neoadjuvant chemotherapy to. It would allow potentially for concurrent validation because it would be the same trial, and potentially more robust diagnostics because we can work them out simultaneously. The patients that would have been in a neoadjuvant trial can just participate in your adjuvant trial, so potentially it would also save resources in terms of patient selections because you wouldn't have to do two studies. You could just use them. But it's complicated. It sounds easier than it really would be. But I think we're working on there. This is a problem we're facing today, and it's, what do you do if you do not get a PCR? So we know that getting a PCR is a really good thing. We know that if you don't get a PCR, it's not as good, but it's not necessarily bad, because some people who don't get a PCR do really well. So that gives us this big problem again. And we have the residual risk strategy. And I think one of the things I deal with is a problem of more of the same. So what we want to do as oncologists is, if we have a patient and we've given them AC followed by Taxol, and we do surgery, and we get the staging back, and they've got 5 positive lymph nodes, we want to do something because we know that that person, you know, has a higher risk of recurrence. So we use the available therapies, and usually, you know, I know people do in the community, it's capecitabine, it's venlafaxine, it's whatever it is, but I'm not sure it makes sense to add more of the same when the chemotherapy didn't work. You know, we have, in triple negative disease, I think people are pretty convinced that you can look for a PCR chemotherapy response in that situation. And if you don't get it with 3 or 4 agents of the best available, there's not a lot to say we're going to, you know, we're really going to help by adding the drug adjuvantly. And we've heard from Debbie Collier that patients really hate to get it. And it's a problem, you know, because patients were like, oh, now you've got this, these nodes, what are we going to do? And it's a problem in terms of relapsing both locally, you know, what do we do with these patients locally? That goes back to the sentinel lymph node problem. But also systemically, you know, what are we going to do with these people? I'm very excited about designs where you use proposed randomized trials for post-preoperative therapy. So what I'm thinking about this is, potentially you could select out the good actors by people who got a PCR, and I think in combination with Soon's data that he presented this morning, you know, there might be a way we can combine molecular profiling and response to chemotherapy to get a select group that we can then use our novel therapeutics after the neoadjuvant therapy. It gives us a potential to run smaller trials. This is the trial that was proposed, and I'm going to be really frank and challenge the audience to say, I'm not sure what I would do with this trial because there's no control group. You know, I do think we should look at adjuvant therapy in the high risk of recurrence patients. I think potentially, because what we have are targeted therapies, that that might be a better way to go with a targeted therapy or potentially a chemotherapy and a targeted therapy combined together. But in this trial design, there's no placebo. There's no treatment group. And it's going to be very difficult to incorporate this into our practice. So we're going to have to, you know, just bite the bullet and understand that people are going to have a risk of recurrence, but we're going to have to include a placebo group. And whether these, so that's why I've eliminated. I'm just learning my animation skills, but that's why I've eliminated in there. I don't have enough animation to put the placebo up there yet. That's the next time. Whether it's targeted or targeted plus chemotherapy, I know these are hard to do. Patients and docs want more therapy if they know that it was for recurrence, but this is really the only way we're going to move forward in a way that doesn't defeat our other endpoints. This is the second to the final slide. Inflammatory breast cancer I wanted to bring up as a paradigm for rare diseases. We're good at looking at large studies, not so good at looking at rare diseases. So inflammatory breast cancer is a rare disease. And how do we study rare disease? You know, do we need more basic science? How do we incentivize those? Do we best study them in a registry? Do we do international randomized trials? And I think this is a really important problem because as we keep subtyping breast cancer, we're going to have more and more rare diseases. So we really have to figure out how we're going to test rare diseases and breast cancer. And I really don't know how to do that. I do know it's going to be a partnership with everybody else, so I hit the wrong button, with academia, industry, government, and advocacy. And that's one of the reasons I'm happy to have this kind of a meeting, because I think it really brings people together to start thinking about the hard questions so that we can make sure our early work goes forward. Thank you.
Thanks, Joanne. Okay, our final speaker is Mary Lou Smith, who is going to talk about the role of advocacy in preoperative trials. She's a co-founder of the Research Advocacy Network. Welcome and thank you. You advance the slides by hitting
the left button. Okay, great. Well, I'm very aware that you've all sat in those seats for a long time, and I am the last presentation before lunch. Lisa understands the situation. So my hope is that you will take something of value from the next 10 minutes that you can use in your work. And this will be a little different. We have no charts, no graphs, and no pointer. And no advancing of the slides.
There you go.
There we go. The role of the advocate is to provide the patient perspective to the research process. We support the science and translate the science and to lay language for patient decision making. We also try and influence policy, and we do that by trying to help early therapies get payment and coverage, access issues, and increase funding.
Can we get
much
closer to the mic?
Oh, sure. I want to explain that advocates and patients are not the same, so I'm going to explain things from the patient perspective and then from the advocate perspective. Patients typically, my family would never believe this. Okay, family. patients have a varied knowledge of their disease, while advocates have a much more in-depth knowledge of a specific cancer. The focus of the patient is on their family and themselves, while the advocate focuses on the healthcare system and understanding the latest findings. The main concern of the patient is for the best treatment, while the main concern of the advocacy is influencing research and healthcare delivery. The patient is on an emotional roller coaster, while the advocate really takes their passion and uses it for the larger community. So I'd like us to take a few moments now and think about this from the patient perspective. We want to focus on what she needs to understand in order to know preoperative therapy and whether it might be an appropriate treatment for her. What happens to a patient when they're diagnosed with cancer? They're told they have something that's growing in their body that could kill them. The natural human reaction is to want it out. When we do our research about cancer, we find out that even small tumors have cancer cells that can migrate through the bloodstream to distant organs. And when we talk to our family and friends, they tell us they've never heard of anybody waiting to have surgery. Research, thankfully, has produced a lot of options for the patient. However, the patient really wants the best treatment. And while you as physicians are really excited about these options, for the patient, it does add to the complexity of her decision-making, and it does create more stress. Explaining the treatment options and helping her determine what is the best treatment for her takes time. You'll hear that patients say, "I understand," but you as doctors need to verify with active listening what it is she actually knows. The words we use to talk about breast cancer treatment don't make it easier for the patient. A great source of information right now for patients is the internet. Leading cancer sites list treatment options beginning with surgery, not with preoperative therapy. When preoperative therapy is queried on the internet, it does not appear as a breast cancer treatment. And I think Deb said this yesterday. Most of all, this is a life decision. We need to help the patient understand what are the costs in dollars and discomfort. What is the effect on future treatments, and how much time is this going to take away from family and from her work? I think Dr. Miller said something very interesting this morning when talked about the fact that quality of life decisions are accepted by patients, that they really do know what is the appropriate decision for them. So I think it's important for us to ask patients what their priorities and values are. Because if we don't, we have no choice but to substitute our own. It's important for patients to understand something about the new science, about what it means to research and what it could mean ultimately to patient care. And we need to separate out what about this new science is going to help this patient versus what is going to help the research and future patients. The Research Advocacy Network developed a brochure explaining tissue research for the IUDOD Breast Cancer Center of Excellence. We shared this brochure with Rosemary Padberg at the NCI, and she used the approach with focus groups of patients and nurses in developing the NCI brochure on providing tissue for research. When the Research Advocacy Network was approached by a large pharmaceutical company to develop educational materials, we presented them with the NCI brochure. They loved it, but they thought they wanted a more expanded explanation of the risks and protections in tissue research. So we developed an 8-page booklet. Both these tools, the NCI brochure and the RAND booklet, are available at no cost. They can be downloaded from respective websites or printed copies can be ordered. The bottom line is this was a successful collaboration that provided information for patients with varying levels of information needs. So we've said that advocates and patients are not the same. So what are the advocate questions? How many patients have responded or progressed with preoperative therapy? How many patients were overtreated? Does preoperative therapy enhance the rate of breast conservation? Does it improve response? Does response correlate with outcome? What does a proven therapy mean to a patient? Is it only available at academic medical centers? Or is it available in the community, and if so, how is it used? Are patients at academic medical centers really the same as those in the community? The Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group found that the average age of women in their breast cancer trials is 51. The SEER data shows the average age as 65. We also know that patients at academic medical centers who enter trials are really more likely to be white, better educated, and have a higher socioeconomic status. Given these differences, can we really take the results of clinical trials and apply them to the community? Will the results be the same? Researchers and advocates have many common interests, and I think this trial, which has already been mentioned, is an example. Advocates want to be able to compare and contrast AIs, and they want to know which patient population is going to benefit from which AI, and they'd like to educate patients about how to use AIs in this particular setting. Researchers, in addition, want to do clinical trials using AIs and chemotherapy and want to know which is the right AI to use. So advocates think that what you're doing here is very important. We think it's important to disseminate the information of what the research has shown, what the questions are that still exist, and what are the gaps in knowledge and clinical practice. Advocates can help inform the process by telling you what are the questions patients have. We'd like an opportunity to ask questions, and we'll help by providing patient information through our websites, through our conferences, support groups, and hotlines. So this is an opportunity for us to collaborate, and I'd like to thank the organizers for including a patient representative.
All righty. Thank you very much. So actually, we're going to have a small change in plans here in recognition of the time, and basically we'll break now for lunch. We'll ask everybody to be back promptly at 1:45 when we will have the question and answer from this session, and then the panel will begin at 2 o'clock, so we will not be very much behind. All right? Thanks, everyone, and again, thanks to all the speakers. All right, so we're going to reconvene as promised. We're going to start with the Q&A from the last session, and then at about 2 o'clock we'll proceed to the panel itself. In terms of the questions from last time, obviously if you have any, please make your way to the microphones, either upstairs or downstairs, and we'll call on you. But while we're waiting, these talks obviously generated any number of complex and interrelated questions. Along the morning, I had one, which I think we have to struggle with a little bit, and that is this. Historically, in-breast response for any chemotherapy regimen has been numerically higher than any other site of response. This is a bigger issue than it may seem at first, because the issue here is that we're using the in-breast response to greater or lesser degree as a surrogate for the ultimate outcome, and the ultimate outcome is actually being driven by the viability and responsiveness of the micrometastases. And I put this open to the panel. How are we going to cross that particular wide gulf? You can defer to Don Berry if you want, since he's not here. But but you know, Sun, you're the right one, because that may be a big part of what goes on in B27.
Possibly. I mean, you know, that's why I regard PCR as Don suggested, as one of the correlates that we can use, but not as an absolute surrogate. I think it's very important to realize that. He made a great point.
So I want to follow it, and we'll go to the questions. It raises the possibility that part of what's going on here relates to tissue-specific gene activation and stromal factors, which we're sort of pointedly ignoring through all of this. And I wonder, Matt or anybody looking at the or Lios, you know, as you drill down on these tissues, how are we going to account for tissue-specific variability that may have a lot to do with what's going on in this regard?
Can I just make two comments on that, Cliff? I mean, one thing, clearly in the impact study anyway, the gross data on the biomarker at Ki-67 did reflect outcome in attack, and that, you know, what was great having the combination arm in that, which performed really very similarly and against many people's expectations, so that was a good control. So at least the gross level, the micrometastases in that circumstance seemed to reflect in what was going on in the primary tumor. There was a statement made though by Stefan Brown last week. It was almost an off-the-cuff remark in the St. Gallen meeting, and certainly Nancy picked it up, where he said something to the effect of the genetic makeup of the micrometastases, these are cells in blood, was different from the primaries, which I think is a bit of a surprise to many of us when we think about the macrometastases being relatively similar. It may be just that in both cases they're different, and in one case he's looking for differences, and in one case we're looking for similarities. But I think it's an important issue as to what those differences might be.
So I think the question that you brought up, Cliff, about the in-breast responses and the clinical response rates, which are very high, is actually very important. And it really has a very unsettling connotation. So most people respond, but the vast majority do not benefit from these more intensive therapies. So clearly, the curves show that there is actually a difference. It's an 8%. Or somewhere there, difference in disease, recurrence-free survival. It's a very interesting coincidence that this 8% absolute improvement, which is borderline statistical significance based on Dr. Wollmar's presentation, is the exact same number, which is the absolute numerical improvement in PCR rate. So 10% of the people actually, 10% more achieve PCR, and there is a 10% improvement in recurrence-free survival. So one way to put this together is really the only people who benefit are the ones. So the majority who benefit really is this very small subpopulation who is pushed from a residual disease category to this pathological CR category. This is an entirely possible explanation for the results. And it clearly shows that responses are very far from being any valuable surrogate for long-term outcome, because long-term outcome is very little, whereas almost everybody has responses.
I think one of the strongest argument against your notion is that, you know, if there is a extreme difference between primary tumor and the micrometastatic site for the gene expression pattern, then we shouldn't have been able to develop Oncotype assay or 7-agent assays, because that's all based on primary tumor,
right,
and still is able to, you know, predict the outcome and respond.
I think part of my questions was answered by your question, Dr. Hardis, but I still, you know, when I came to this conference, I wanted three questions answered, at least partly answered. One was, who are the patients whom we target neoadjuvant therapy? Number two is, what is this role, this glorified role of a pathological complete response? And number three is, how do we recognize those non-responders more than the responders? Because, you know, if our goal is tailored therapy, which is seem to be the biggest goal that we're doing this neoadjuvant therapy, is how do we then stop giving something that, you know, this patient is not responding? Now, I want to forget the first two questions because I realize there's a lot of controversy there and there's really not one school of thought. But I just want to ask you regarding this tailored therapy. It would be really nice if there is some kind of guidelines that can be universally used. At least, you know, we talked about radiological evidence of early response, but, you know, think about this. This is not something that can be applied to a community hospital, you know, for several years down the road. First of all, we have to prove its reproducibility, and then it depends on the person who's doing it, and there's a lot of questions there. So the one thing that can be done is clinical response. That's something that every oncologist can see. You know, you give two cycles of AC, no change in the tumor. Is that the patient we stop giving AC and switch to Taxol? I mean, that is a question that has that been looked at, and do you have any guidelines regarding that, which I think then can be carried on to a community oncologist, at least in the interim period before we know more answers.
Who wants to...
I don't think we know the answer yet. I think that I'm not even a panel member, but I'm going to put my R in, and I'm going to say that I think when a patient doesn't respond after two cycles with disease in the breast, it can't be a good thing, but I think we don't actually totally know how that plays out in the long haul in terms of whether they would do better with a switch. Some of the limited data we have, for example, the Aberdeen study, shows that everybody does better with a switch, whether they're responding or they're not responding. I don't know if other people would like to comment on that specifically.
So, you know, the only difference is that you actually know this. I mean, if you would do the same chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting, you would not know it. I mean, how does this benefit you, or how does this benefit the patient, or how does this benefit the progress of science? So really, what neoadjuvant chemotherapy brings into the light is that, yeah, very often these treatments actually, I mean, we don't understand who benefits from it and who are the individuals who don't. And the only way to actually find these markers is to use the treatment as neoadjuvant therapy. So I think it's important to separate issues, that why is this really relevant for research, and what's the value of this in clinical practice. And again, I think many things are known about neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And one thing which is known is that if you give the same chemotherapy before or after surgery, the outcome is the exact same. And that's a fact. It's been shown by four randomized studies. But you can make a more refined question, that is there a subset who might possibly be harmed, or might, and sure, there might be a subset, but we don't know who they are. And it's the same goes for any kind of chemotherapy, adjuvant chemotherapy. Is there a subset who might hurt by giving Taxol AC rather than CMF? Might be, but you don't know that.
Matthew, push your red button.
So I think when we're thinking about medical oncology, there are two real extremes. The extreme is when you know precisely the target you should target, and you have a drug that works against that target. So the example there would be GIST tumors of the stomach, or CML, for example. And the other extreme is when you haven't got a clue what the genomic structure of the tumor is, and you're using relatively nonspecific drugs, and you don't really exactly understand how they work. And that is essentially where you are when you're discussing Taxol or cyclophosphamide in untargeted populations of patients with, you know, unselected populations of patients with breast cancer. So my only sort of thought for the day is that the one thing that these preoperative studies will do will provide material on which we can build genome maps and allow those maps to actually be clinically annotated. Because one of the problems that we're facing right now, you know, you open the pages of Science and Nature, and there's these, I won't say irritating, because they're incredible tour de forces, but basically the paper says something like, the breast cancer genome is incredibly complex, and look, aren't we clever, we found 250 mutations in 10 samples. And that actually is not very helpful. What you need to put is all those 250 mutations in the context of events that happen to patients.
Right.
So to try and begin to get at this at WashU, together with many of the colleagues in my room, we're trying to take the engine of the genome sequencing centers and the genomic analysis techniques we can do now, and to do all that wonderful high-throughput genomic analysis in the context of these studies. And NHGRI are very interested in this. And I think, right. So we're beginning to get some, we're beginning to get to a system where we'll get answers, but right now we don't have any.
So we're all sensitive to really, I think, the crux of your question, which is what do we do in practice versus what are we talking about from a research point of view? And I think the answers are decidedly different. And in practice, most of this is not ready for implementation, and that's the bottom line. At least I'll speak editorially, not for everybody else. So, Brian.
Leyland Jones Emery. I just wanted Mario to ask you one specific thing and Lajos to ask something a bit broader. So, Mario, you showed the data on the hormone negative HER2 positive data in one of your slides, which showed really quite a lot worse 5-year DFS and 5-year OS as opposed to the triple negatives. And I just wondered if you had any explanation for that. I trust this was pre-trastuzumab, but the difference was quite striking, how much worse the HER2-positive group did than the triple-negatives.
This is one of the explanations. This is the era pre-trastuzumab. The other explanation I have is that in our institution, we frequently use the cisplatinum-containing regimen, the preoperative setting, the old ECF. So we suppose we treat quite adequately the patients with triple-negative subtypes, whereas we didn't treat it adequately the patients with HER2-positive disease.
Interesting. So Lajos, the broader question is, as much as I love your trial design, the new neoadjuvant one, basically most of your neoadjuvants, at least in our practice, who are HER2-positive, will get trastuzumab prior to surgery. Your non-responding ones, basically, you wouldn't expect to do well on the sort of the phase one part. And I'm just wondering what kind of patients you could enter with equipoise onto that trial, you know, in the splay between the full gamut of ER positive, whatever, in order to show a difference. You know, in other words, what kind of patients you would randomize. And I'm really asking this in the light of Martine's comment yesterday about excluding luminal A's or the ER positives for that kind of study. So I'm just wondering what quite answer you'll get out of that, because I'd have thought that a lot of your ER positive ones would generally have got into other trials anyway.
Well, personally, I...
This is for Lajos. Sorry.
I agree with Martin in the sense that I would not candidate a patient with a luminal A to a trial with chemotherapy questions. I mean, dose dance versus centrocycline and taxanes. I believe this patient should be candidated to endocrine questions. And what I saw in this conference, there are several trials on endocrine treatment in endocrine responsive patients, but mainly focusing on postmenopausal patients, mainly possibly frail postmenopausal patients. I didn't say anything about premenopausal patients, which represent about 60% of the patients candidated to preoperative therapies in our experience. 2/3 of these patients are ER positive or endocrine responsive disease. And I believe we need targeted questions for this very large population, as we have in the adjuvant setting where we have a trial like the text trial, the soft trial, with specific question for the specific population. This was the message I would like to explain with my presentation. So several populations should be treated with a really targeted treatment.
So, Brian, the study that I showed is not a randomized study. It's really a molecular triaging study. So if you are HER2-positive, then you get trastuzumab plus standard chemotherapy. In our case, it's Vicritexol, and then subsequently FAC. And if you are predicted to have complete response to new adjuvant chemotherapy, regardless of the ER status, then they get new adjuvant chemotherapy. And there the study ends with surgery. So postoperatively, you can add additional treatments, including hormonal therapy for the ER positives if you want to, particularly if their ER sensitivity signature also predicts sensitivity there. The third group is the group who does not do well, or we predict that they have residual disease to Taxol FAC, but at the same time are highly sensitive to endocrine treatment based on another predictor. And those individuals will get neoadjuvant endocrine therapy for 6 months and then surgery. And we try to learn what early surrogates might be there, like cell cycle arrest or what kind of PCR rate we see in that highly selected endocrine sensitive group. And postoperatively, of course, they will continue with 5 years of tamoxifen, and they surely have an option to get chemotherapy if they want to. Granted that they understand that we predict that they won't do well with it, or they probably won't be helped, or the majority of that group won't be helped by it. And the fourth group is the group that does not do well according to our predictions with any of these treatments, and they just get triaged into an investigational treatment. And then we look at the entire group at one point and see what PCR rates we generated by this. And if we see a PCR rate, a combined PCR rate of 25%, greater than 25%.
Yes, it was that box on that left-hand side which confused me.
To increase PCR rates than just giving the best chemotherapy to everybody. And of course, time will tell whether these people actually will live longer or have less recurrence. But we will certainly track that too.
Thank you.
The left microphone.
I wanted to follow up on Joanne's comment about translating pathologic complete response into clinical practice. And my particular question is, what is the metric from a regulatory, from a reimbursement, from a guideline or standard of practice point of view by which you could look at data 4 or 5 years from now from the various preoperative studies that we have and say, based on these changes in PATH-CR in these subgroups of patient, therefore we should offer X patient, you know, X treatment to Y patients? Because it seems a challenge to me, and notwithstanding Don's enthusiasm for modeling, that we still don't have the metric. We don't know if a 15% improvement in PATH-CR leads to a 2% or 1% improvement in overall survival. So I guess the question is, what sort of things from a regulatory point of view would one like to see before adopting this as a standard of care for patients?
Well, I think that's why I had it as a question. You know, right now, from a regulatory point of view, since PATH-CR, at least as far as I'm concerned, hasn't been, and the FDA as well, you know, it's not a true surrogate for the outcome that we care about. And I really don't know how to get here there from here. You know, I suspect that we can if we concentrate on the subtypes for whom PATH-CR is useful, like those who get them as opposed to those who don't. And then we would really have to prospectively validate it. I don't see another way around it. And I'm concerned, as I mentioned, with the triple negative, that because of feasibility, we won't get there. You know, I'm hopeful that we'll increase the PATH-CR, and I'm hopeful that we'll be able to do a randomized trial. And maybe if we have a more or less homogeneous group in that particular subset, it could be prospectively validated. But those are a lot of ifs, you know, and I do think it's a problem.
Frankie.
Oh, Frankie Holmes, Houston. Terrific session today, and I just want to put on the table, since today we're more biologically directed than yesterday, the question that was raised in the context of addressing response: is there a role here for a simple blood test, like circulating tumor cells in those patients who have them? Would that be useful? I was looking around for Dan, but I think he isn't here. Just to put on the table, recognizing that many patients don't have them, but would that be useful, especially in that patient who didn't respond after 2 cycles of AC?
Another lecture.
I think that's a very interesting question, and we've been trying to incorporate the kind of question into our trial, but I think the problem is that, for example, circulating tumor cells, you need so much blood to be able to detect one tumor cell in adjuvant setting that we thought that it's actually practically not doable in this kind of trial population.
1, 2, 7.5 CCs.
Although you actually need about 30 ml of blood to get one cell. So, and, you know, if you look at standard deviation and all that, I don't know how you can really make out of the data that's generated with only a few cells and their changes during the course of treatment. I think that's the major issue.
I just wanted to clarify that, you know, in the metastatic setting, there's a lot of circulating tumor cells, so they're able to pick it up, you know, 7 tumor cells or 5 or whatever it is. But in the adjuvant setting, it's not as easy. There's not as many cells, you know, floating around. So the real challenge is, as Soon mentioned, with having to draw a lot of blood, not picking up many cells. And I'm then wondering if those are truly cancer cells or just the cell floating around is still an obstacle to using that type of test in an early stage disease setting.
Okay, in view of the time, we're going to take 2 more questions. So the left microphone and then...
Pat Stig, NCI. It's a question for Soon Paik. If I heard you right, you used a 90-gene prognostic signature in your talk to separate good from poor. Is that a previously known one, a new one? Can you provide some information?
No, this is purely based on this population and just cross-validated within the population. So it is extremely preliminary data that needs to be confirmed in other studies. But
and
if you
how did you get
the,
it? How did you get the? How did you classify the data to get that signature?
Oh, so there
and
is
does
a,
it look like any of the other known signatures?
Oh, there is a specific procedure called supervised principal component analysis developed by Stanford Group that actually allows you to look at the data, pull out the genes that correlate with clinical outcome, and then do a principal component analysis to put them into the 2 groups. But I just presented the data in 2 equal size groups, but you can divide them in any way you want. It's actually a continuous variable.
And does that signature look like any of the other published signatures?
Yeah, actually, it's very much look like Oncotype DXRC. Okay. It's mainly driven by ER/HER2 and other genes. They're very familiar to us.
Okay, thanks.
So it's actually, I'm just showing that as an example of the research question that you can answer with the tissue. And obviously, regardless of what kind of signature you use or combination of some classical markers, we'll probably derive exactly the same thing.
Okay. And just a quick comment to Cliff. Ari, your previous discussion on these signatures versus site-specific growth, you're all right. I mean, from my read of the literature, there are metastasis or poor outcome signatures clearly in primary tumors. But layered onto that, there are site-specific growth signatures as well as differences in circulating tumor cells.
Well, actually, just to add a little more granularity, I was really referring to the stroma, which is another layer on top of that. So
the
I agree with you.
Stroma in the breast and stroma in the lung are 2 different things.
Right. Final question. Thank you.
Dr. Dowsett, you showed data that patients who had high Ki-67 levels at their excision did markedly worse than those who didn't. And you interpreted that as saying that if you have a high Ki-67 at baseline and don't get a PASCR, you're going to do poorly. And I wondered, those patients really have 2 strikes against them. One is that they don't have a PASCR, and the other is that their tumor doesn't respond in terms of reducing proliferative index in it after therapy. And so I wondered if you could tease that apart by specifically looking at the patients who had high Ki-67 at baseline and then at the excision had residual disease but did have a reduction in that Ki-67. So in other words, if you have a baseline Ki-67 and don't have a PASCR, are you destined to do poorly? Or if your tumor is responding to the Ki-67 reduction, then that can salvage things?
I mean, very briefly, I don't think we've done it as cleanly as you'd like, but the implications of the data as a package do support that. That those patients that have those very high Ki-67 levels at excision do very poorly, and clearly those are patients that didn't get a PASCR, yet we know that the patients that generally have high proliferation have a greater tendency to get PASCR. So I think we essentially need to do what you're asking to give you a cleaner answer.
Right, so basically the patients who had high Ki-67 at baseline, if that goes down without a PASCR, do then those people do well, or are they still destined to have high recurrence rates, I guess is the question.
The patients that go down but don't have a PASCR.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, they have an improved likelihood of response. So we showed that, Andreas's data showed that quite some time ago. But that was using 21-day data rather than the 3-month data.
Okay. Thanks.
So, go ahead, Kath.
We'd just like to thank all the speakers very much and for all the questions. Thank you very much.